Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
There is growing alarm over the use of altered videos online, especially those known as deep fakes, which are highly realistic looking and inaccurate. There are concerns about their growing sophistication and the risk they pose to national security. It is the focus of a hearing tomorrow in the House Intelligence Committee. Miles O'Brien has a look at how those videos, once the source of some fun, are being manipulated, and how artificial intelligence scientists are trying to respond. It's part of our weekly segment on the leading edge of science.
Hi, this is you being me.
Scary as deepfake videos may be, there are times when they can be fun. A place where a 3D model of my face gets electronically plastered onto computer scientist Hao Li's head, making him the puppet master and me the dummy.
Really a scary-looking individual overall. What do you think? I do need to change my hair, don't I? Yeah.
Li is an associate professor at the University of Southern California and co-founder of Pinscreen, an app that allows consumers to make instant custom 3D avatars for virtual reality gaming and shopping.
So now you created your avatar, right? So we have your...
A nice trim Miles O'Brien.
The real-time puppet master trick is how he refines the technology.
And here I am as our president. Yep. Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan. Mm-hmm. Zhang, leader of China. Trudeau? That's not a bad look for me. Me as Justin Bieber. What do you think? I think I'm going to do this on the NewsHour all the time now. This will be good for my career, don't you think?
Li says he never saw it as anything more than entertainment.
Of course, it can be used for something really bad, but the main purpose was never for that. It was used for entertainment, a fun tool that could give us more things to do for fashion, lifestyle, etc.
Deepfake videos cleverly combine what's real with what is synthesized by a computer to make people appear to say things they never did or never would.
I like vodka.
The ever-increasing speed of computers, along with the advancement of the artificial intelligence technique called machine learning, is making these composites harder and harder to detect with the naked eye.
We all assume that there will be a point where there's no way to tell the difference. I mean, for visual effects, I think you can get pretty close already. It's just the question of how much effort you put into it. But in terms of content that can be created by anyone, I think it's getting very close to the point.
This was very truly surprising for me.
One technique is the face swap, which puts Steve Buscemi's face on Jennifer Lawrence's body, Nicolas Cage onto a series of marquee stars in iconic roles.
Terrific.
or Jimmy Kimmel's mug on mine.
So I've had to relearn very simple things.
But there is a deep, dark side as well. Indeed, the technology has been used to paste the faces of celebrities onto the bodies of porn stars. Computer scientist Hani Farid is a professor at Dartmouth College.
I am worried about the weaponization, and I'm worried about how it's impacting us as a society. So we are working as hard as possible to detect these things.
Killmonger was right.
This video crystallized much of the deep concern. What seems to be President Barack Obama making a speech...
You see, I would never say these things.
...is actually comedian and filmmaker Jordan Peele doing his excellent Obama impersonation synced with software created with artificial intelligence, or AI.
The AI system synthesized the mouth of President Obama to be consistent with the audio stream, and it made it look like President Obama was saying things that he never said. That's called a lip sync deepfake.
Just this week, the technique was used to put some pretty outrageous and comical words into the mouth of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg.
Spectre showed me that whoever controls the data controls the future.
It's a potent technology that is ripening at a time of deep polarization and suspicion fueled by social media.
So it's really sad. And here's the thing.
Just last month, something much less sophisticated than a deep fake, a doctored video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi making her seem drunk, went viral.
We want to give this president the opportunity to do something historic.
Deep fakes ratchet up the risks.
The nightmare situation is that there's a video of President Trump saying, I've launched nuclear weapons against North Korea. And somebody hacks his Twitter account, and that goes viral, and in 30 seconds we have global nuclear meltdown. Do I think it's likely? No. But it's not a zero probability. And that should scare the bejesus out of you, right? Because the fact that that is not impossible is really worrisome.
Farid is most worried about deepfakes rearing their ugly head during the 2020 election. So he and his team are carefully learning the candidates' patterns of speech and how they correlate with gestures as a way to spot deepfakes.
We do that, of course, by analyzing hundreds of hours of video of individuals. We're focused on building models for all of the major party candidates so that we can upload a video to our system. We can analyze it by comparing it to previous interviews and then asking what is the probability that this is consistent with everything we've seen before.
Computer scientists have pushed this technology using generative adversarial networks, or GANs. A GAN pits two artificial intelligence algorithms against each other. One strives to create realistic fake images, while the other grades the effort.
So the synthesis engine says, I'm going to create a fake image. I give it to this AI system that says, this looks fake to me. So it goes back and you change it and you do that a few billion times in rapid succession. And the computers are teaching each other how to make better fakes. And that's what has democratized access.
And that's why the Pentagon is interested in deep fakes. Its research enterprise, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is exploring ways to defend against the threat of deepfakes. Computer scientist Matt Turek runs DARPA's Media Forensics, or MEDAFOR, project.
So there's an opportunity here for us to essentially lose all trust in images and video.
Turek showed me some of the 70 counter deepfake techniques DARPA is helping nurture.
It's necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another.
This software is designed to characterize lip movement and compare it to the audio.
And so when we see these red bars, that means actually that the sounds of the speaker are not actually consistent with the movement of the lips.
Take a look at this video. Supposedly two people sitting together. But software that determines the lighting angle on faces concludes it is a composite.
So it estimates a 3D model for the face. Along with that 3D model, it estimates the reflectance properties of the face and also the lighting angles. And so here we're primarily using the lighting angles to see whether those are consistent or not.
In this example, video apparently gathered by a security camera shows only one car. This artificial intelligence algorithm is designed to predict how things should move.
What that's triggering off of is discontinuities in the motion. And so that gives us a signal to look at an image or video and say, well, perhaps frames were removed.
And it flags the video as altered. Another vehicle was edited out.
There's a cat and mouse game. The more aspects that you can use to debunk an image or video, the more burden that you put on the manipulator.
But none of these ideas will work without the cooperation of the big social media platforms, YouTube and Facebook, which would need to deploy the software and delete the fakes, something Facebook refused to do when the Pelosi video emerged.
The platforms have been, for the most part, very cavalier about how they deal with this type of illegal content, harmful content, misinformation, fake news, election tampering, non-consensual pornography, and the list goes on, because it gets eyes on the platform, and that's good for business.
A fake video, amplified in an echo chamber, can go an awfully long way before the facts even enter the picture. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Los Angeles.
We're well into June, and summer is just around the corner. For some, that means lawn mowing, beaches, pools, and sunscreen. A study published recently in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, found active ingredients in sunscreen were absorbed into the bloodstream. The significance of that is still unclear. So to offer some guidance, we're joined by Tricia Calvo of Consumer Reports. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This study was conducted by some FDA researchers. Can you tell us more about what they found?
They found that some of the chemical active ingredients in sunscreen, oxybenzone, avobenzone, was absorbed through the skin. But they did not make a determination about whether or not that meant health effects, health side effects from that absorption.
You were behind Consumer Reports' extensive ranking of sunscreens. So in light of this news, how should we think about our choice of sunscreen? What should we look for?
Well, the first thing to remember is that you need to use sunscreen. The risks of sun exposure to your skin, skin cancer, sunburn, are very well established. So you still need to use sunscreen when you're going to be outside and on exposed skin. The FDA has said that they consider that titanium dioxide and zinc oxide as active ingredients are safe and aren't absorbed through the skin. However, in Consumer Reports tests of sunscreens, we found that they don't perform as well. So one thing that you might want to consider is using a sunscreen that does not have oxybenzone. Of all the chemical active ingredients, that's the one that seems to be most worrisome, although it's far from determined whether or not it is actually a problem. It's also the ingredient that can possibly harm the coral reefs.
That was my next question. We've been hearing about this idea that sunscreen can be damaging to the environment, and it feels a little bit like we can't win in terms of choices. I mean, am I wrong about that?
You know, that research is still in the early stages as well, and I don't want to undermine it or underplay it, but you have to think about things sort of globally. And one thing that you can do is, if you're concerned about sunscreen use, is you can just be extra careful about covering up.
So I know for my own kid, the swimsuit I got for him has long sleeves, and I'm always putting like a big hat on him. So you're telling me that's not overkill?
That is not overkill. That's actually a great idea. You know, there are a lot of sun protective clothing options on the market now. So that will help protect the environment because you're using less sunscreen. And it will also help protect you against any potential problems with sunscreen ingredients.
In the end, how big a deal is this study published by JAMA?
I think it's great that the FDA has called for more information, but I'm concerned that people will take that information and not really understand what's behind it and then stop using sunscreen or think that sunscreen is definitely harmful. It's important to remember that none of that has been established yet, and even the FDA has said you shouldn't stop using sunscreen with these active ingredients.
In the meantime, when you're going to the beach, what are you going to be using?
I use sunscreen all the time, but I'm also really careful to cover up. So if you came across me on the beach, you would see me in a long sleeve shirt under an umbrella with a towel over my feet so I didn't get sunburn. But I use sunscreen regularly.
So I don't have to bring back the parasol just yet. That's what I was thinking of.
But you know what? That's not a bad idea.
Tricia Calvo, Deputy Health and Food Editor at Consumer Reports. Thanks for hashing it out with us.
Thank you, Audie.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
The Vatican issued an official document this week rejecting the idea that people can choose or change their gender. It says that allowing gender to be determined by personal feeling rather than biology would be to, quote, annihilate nature. The document was prepared earlier this year, but has been released now, smack in the middle of LGBTQ Pride Month. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli covers the Vatican. She is here in our studio now. Hey, Sylvia, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So the official title of this document, Male and Female, He Created Them. What else does it say?
Well, essentially, it blasts what's called the gender theory, saying that it ignores natural differences between men and women, and that it's a threat to the concept of the traditional family. It rejects this notion of gender fluidity, and it's aimed at Catholic teachers, parents, students, and clergy to help address what the authors call an educational crisis in the field of sexual orientation.
Do we know who wrote it?
It was written by two Italians who head the Vatican Department on Catholic Education, Cardinal Giuseppe Versaldi and Archbishop Angelo Zani. It was not signed by the Pope, but it quotes from his speeches, and it makes no reference to whether the Pope reviewed it or not.
So do we know whether it's in line with his views and his official position?
Oh, absolutely. This is an issue on which it disturbs him a lot. He's very upset about it, in fact. So it's not surprising that the Vatican has issued a document. But frankly, he has been contradictory on some of these issues. You could say almost he's been pretty fluid.
Because he has said more progressive things than some of his predecessors in terms of gay rights.
Absolutely. Famously, he said, "Who am I to judge?" when he was asked about an alleged gay priest working at the Vatican. And he has made it very clear the need for outreach to gay people. But on gender identity, he's very tough. Once he said it's part of a world war against marriage, an example of ideological colonization that's been spreading in many parts of the world.
Well, talk to me about the timing and the fact that this was issued right in the middle of Pride Month. Is the Vatican making a point here?
Well, probably. It's actually formally it's dated February 4th, but of course the fact that it's coming out now, it can't be. It's making a statement. It contains sections that talk very positively about the need to avoid discrimination. But it is essentially a document that takes a very strong stand against the fear that schools will start introducing this and that will sort of undermine the authority of parents and teachers in how children are brought up. That's one of the basic fears the Vatican Pope Francis is expressing.
What kind of reaction are you hearing among Catholics, and I suppose specifically LGBTQ Catholics?
Well, there's been very strong criticism. They've denounced the document as contributing to bigotry and violence against gay and transgender people and sending a harmful sign that's a confusing message. Mm. Francis de Bernardo, head of New Ways Ministry, it's an advocacy group, said the document's concepts are outdated and misinformed. He said gender is also biologically determined by genetics, hormones, and brain chemistry, things not visible at birth. But perhaps one of the most forceful criticisms came from a Jesuit priest, Father James Martin, who has written on the need to improve Catholic outreach to the LGBT community. He tweeted, "The document is mainly a dialogue with philosophers and theologians, not with scientists and biologists, certainly not with LGBT people whose experiences are given little, if any, weight." He added, "Sadly, it will be used as a cudgel against transgender people and an excuse to argue that they shouldn't exist."
Wow. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reporting there. Thank you, Sylvia.
Thank you.
The man knot, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood.
Director Ava DuVernay's Netflix miniseries When They See Us has drawn new attention to the case of the Central Park Five. In a special last night, Oprah Winfrey interviewed them. As teenagers, these Black and Latino men were coerced by New York police into falsely confessing to the rape of a white jogger in Central Park in 1989. Their convictions were vacated in 2002 when someone else confessed to her rape. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans is on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So Netflix tweeted yesterday that When They See Us has been their most watched series in the U.S. every day since it was released in late May. This is despite the fact that, as you've written, this is a really hard series to watch.
Yeah, you know, it took me three times to get through watching this series, and I admit I cried while I watched parts of it. But in a way, I think the difficulty of watching some of these scenes, you know, seeing these teenage boys, they were age 14 to 16, being physically and mentally coerced into these false confessions, thinking they could just go home. It's a crucial part of the show's power. I mean, it really makes you experience the trauma that they went through, that their families went through. And this comes at a time when we're already talking about how people of color are over-policed or unfairly policed. So it really resonates.
This miniseries has had some power in other ways, too. One New York prosecutor who is featured as a character in the miniseries, Linda Fairstein, she's called the show an outright fabrication. Fairstein's now a crime novelist, and she was dropped by her publisher, and she resigned from the board of Vassar College. So some real repercussions from this show.
Yeah, you know, it's going back to this high-profile controversy and is trying to unwind the unfairness that led to the unjust convictions and jail time for these teens back when it first happened. And in that process, people are looking back at the police and the prosecutors that were originally involved with the case, and they're saying, you know, shouldn't they also be held to account? Now, as a critic, I did wonder how they came up with some of the language that Fairstein's character uses in some of the scenes where the men and their families couldn't have been present. They couldn't have known what, you know, she said to police. But the series is told from the perspective of these men and their families, and it's focused on showing how the system pushed them into these false confessions and then what happened to them afterwards. And the Fairstein character is a major vehicle for showing that.
And we should note that this miniseries is based on real events, but not a documentary. Eric, we've seen other TV shows that are based on real events bring changes after they go to air. Lifetime's Surviving R. Kelly detailed all of these allegations of sexual assault and statutory rape against him. He's now facing criminal charges. Is this part of some cultural trend, do you think?
Well, I do think that When They See Us and Surviving R. Kelly, they kind of have a lot in common. I mean, they're getting us to reconsider these stories about classic injustice, wealthy people getting away with abuse or people of color unfairly sent to jail. And they're asking us to re-experience those moments through a very powerful TV presentation. And then we're re-experiencing this stuff in a new social context. I mean, the Me Too movement is showing us the value of really listening to abuse victims when they come forward. We have viral videos that show us how some people of color are unfairly policed. And so we feel very differently about these stories now than when they first emerged in the news. And I suspect we're going to see more of these kinds of presentations because people realize they're a way to sort of give voice to marginalized and overlooked voices and challenge these incomplete or unfair versions of history.
Yeah, I guess it is worth thinking about what the next TV miniseries might be. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
As we have discussed on Ring of Fire pretty much since the first day of Ring of Fire, if a big bank thinks they can get away with something to put more money in their pocket and take money out of the pockets of consumers, they're typically going to do that. I mean, the evidence to suggest that is overwhelming. And sometimes even the smaller big banks will take advantage of consumers in ways that these consumers may not even realize. And that is actually what we're seeing right now with an investigation into Regions Bank. Joining me now to explain what's happening is Scott Hardy with Top Class Actions. Scott, this particular story with Regions Bank, to me, is just absolutely one of the most disgusting things banks can do, because this is preying mostly on lower income Americans. You know, people that have to go through the Federal Housing Administration to secure their loans. Typically younger people in many instances, they don't have credit. That's why they have to go through FHA, low-income people. And Regions Bank, so far, what we found through the investigation, appears to be ripping them off. Tell us how this is happening.
Sure. So
The FHA loans, as you mentioned, secured by the Federal Housing Authority. And what you have was a rule that was changed in 2015. Before, they were able to charge you interest for the entire month if you were paying off your loan. So let's say you're moving, you're buying a new house, you sold your house, so now that loan is getting paid off. If there's excess interest, you know, if you pay that off on the 10th and your payment's not due on the 30th, that extra interest from that month should come back to you. But it wasn't. Now, we also see if you refinanced your house, you know, you refinanced that loan. Maybe you got out of that FHA loan and got into a traditional loan because your credit's improved. Well, again, the lawsuits that we're seeing, this investigation is looking into the possibility that Regions Bank charged those clients a full month's worth of interest. And if since it's a mortgage, that could be hundreds, if not $1,000 or more, especially if you're at the very start of your mortgage loan. So this type of practice has bilked out consumers approximately $587.4 million just in 2003 due to excess interest fees. And so what these attorneys are investigating are, if you were a Regions Bank customer, if you had an FHA loan and that was paid off because you sold your house, you refinanced, that kind of thing, they want to take a look at your statement and see if you were charged this interest and see if they can get that money back for you.
One thing, you pointed out there, in 2015, they changed the law to make it to where, I mean, this is a law. You can't do that. You can't charge them interest after the loan has been paid off. Like you said, if you pay it off on the 10th of the month, but your payment wasn't due until the 30th, you cannot legally charge them those 20 days worth of interest. And so what we suspect, what this investigation is trying to find out is this happening? And so far, it appears that most signs point to yes, right?
Right. So far, we're receiving a number of submissions every month from viewers that are stating this has happened to them. But with 1,500 branches across the country, we're thinking that there are a lot more people out there that this happened to that just didn't know about it. That's why we wanted to talk with you about it and really get the word out to say, if you had a Regions Bank FHA loan and it was paid off, you refinanced, take a look at your statement, submit your information, have the attorneys check it out to see if this happened to you. Because as you said, this is an illegal practice, at least since 2015. And you shouldn't be charged that money, and that money should be going right into your pocket and not into a, you know, multi-billion-dollar bank's pockets.
One thing I want to hit on as well, and this is, you know, mentioned in the article, which everybody find a link to that in the description of this video, but it talks about the fact that these FHA loans are more attractive to borrowers, you know, when they're able to get them, because there is no prepayment penalty. Most home loans, if you take them out for 30 years, and say you pay it off in 25, either you've been making, you know, larger payments than needed, or you sell the house, so then you have the money to pay off the loan. Well, guess what? A traditional loan is going to charge you a penalty because you didn't hang on to it for all 30 years. They didn't get 30 full years worth of interest for you. FHAs do not have that. And so that is why, for many people, these can be more attractive. You know, I'm only planning on being in this house for 10 years, so I don't want to have to pay a penalty. I'd rather go through FHA. So there could be a lot more people that, you know, went with these FHA loans through a Regions Bank. And so they need to be aware that they would also, you know, qualify for this. But again, the practice of those prepayment penalties, it's not illegal, but it is a pretty dirty tactic by these banks. Like, we're going to make sure we squeeze every penny out of you as long as we can get it. You know, if you're not going to pay us interest for 30 years, then we're going to slap you with a penalty to make up for the money that we, the bank, lost, even though we've already made tens of thousands of dollars off of you paying your mortgage payment every single month.
Exactly. You know, the banks are making just money hand over fist for those of us who are making our interest payments, our mortgage payments on a regular basis. We're not defaulting. We're not foreclosing. They're making money hand over fist, so it really stinks that you get penalized for either paying off your loan early or just refinancing your loan. And if you're getting penalized and you're paying that extra interest, which may very well be illegal, you know, the lawyers we're working with want to know about it.
Right. And as you pointed out earlier, as mentioned in this piece on top class actions, this could be as much or more than half a billion dollars a year that banks are pocketing just in that, you know, 1 month's worth of interest. It may be a couple hundred dollars or even just a thousand for a consumer, but it's $500 million for these banks each year. Hopefully we'll find out more as this investigation goes on. And obviously this is something we definitely want to follow up on. For anybody who needs more information, please follow the link in the description of this video. Go read up on this investigation. See if this is something you may have been a victim of. And while you're there, sign up for the weekly Top Class Actions newsletter. It has all of this information and more delivered right to your inbox every week. Scott Hardy with Top Class Actions. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
I'm going back to Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali, Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali, Cali.
The San Francisco of 2019, with its tech startups and mile-high rents, is not the San Francisco of actor Jimmy Fails' childhood.
I always say that the Bose Park, which is the park right by my house where I grew up in, kind of looked like a Spike Lee film back in the day. It was just like boom boxes and dice games, just very lively sort of place. There weren't really any white people there when I was living there growing up.
It's also not the San Francisco that director Joe Talbot grew up in.
I grew up sort of hugging the border of Bernal Heights and the Mission District. And for me growing up, that was one of the more diverse areas in San Francisco. And I think, you know, you'd just constantly be around people that were different from you. And that's, you know, part of how Jimmy and I met.
Joe and Jimmy first met as teenagers after Jimmy and his family were pushed out of their home in the historically black Fillmore District. They moved into public housing projects not far from where Joe's family lived, and the two men soon realized they were creatively in sync. Now they've collaborated on a film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco, based loosely on Jimmy's life. In the film, he plays a character, also named Jimmy Fails, who attempts to return to his family's home in a gentrified San Francisco that no longer seems to have space for black Americans. I sat down with Jimmy Fails and Joe Talbot to learn more about how they brought this story of Bay Area gentrification to the screen.
One of the first things we did 5 years ago, we shot a concept trailer. And, you know, part of that was we knew that we were not a very bankable duo. I'm a high school dropout. Jimmy had only ever starred in my movies. But we felt there was something really, you know, compelling here. And it was, in our way, I think, trying to work through our own feelings about San Francisco, both having grown up there and seeing it change in these ways, you know, that felt, made the city that we love feel less and less recognizable.
One of the things that, I mean, there were many, many things that stood out to me in the film, but one of them was the sort of genteel racism among white San Franciscans and their black neighbors, if you will. And that's very familiar to those of us who live in the Northeast, but it's less familiar, I think, to folks in other parts of the country. What, was that a conscious decision to put that in? And I'm thinking specifically of some interactions with Jimmy, your character, and, say, the white tour group that was correcting your character about when the house was built. Of course, there's a plot twist with that.
I can see, you know, there's another interaction with me and the guy when I'm moving the stuff in. And he's like a little weird, you know.
Yep.
Like that one for sure was like supposed to be a weird sort of reaction, you know. And that's, you know, that's often how it feels. It's like the neighborhoods have changed so much that it was meant to feel like, how am I the weird one? You know, it's like, how am I the weird one when I was here before you even were here? So, mm-hmm. you know, so it's that sort of feeling that we were trying to get across with that.
Jim, do you want to tell a story about when you were walking home to our back?
Oh, wow. He always makes me tell a story. But yeah, so it was late at night. I'm walking behind. There's like a white guy walking in front of me. And I get it. I'm kind of bigger and black and it's late at night. So I make it a point to cross the street so that I don't make him feel uncomfortable, because I could feel him kind of keep looking back and, you know, just seeing. And we were just happened to be walking the same way. Down like a one-way street. So it was just like a long sort of street that we had to both kind of go. So I crossed the street. He was still uncomfortable, but eventually we had to go the same way because I was walking back home. So we get to the park, and I'm still walking behind him, and the sprinklers are going, and we cross the street, and I'm, like, closer to him, and he just starts sprinting through the sprinklers, literally, like, just got drenched, just started sprinting, like, and I was just like, okay, like, I was just walking home, but, like, you know, you didn't have to get yourself drenched. I was like, all right, man.
And that's through the neighborhood that we
grew
up in.
And that's the neighborhood we grew up in. And that's like a funny story, but in retrospect, it's like those are the microaggressions you have to deal with, like, a lot, being a black male. And it doesn't make me feel good at the end of the day. It's like you laugh it off in the moment, but it's like that's kind of f***ed up.
It, you know, Joe, you are directing a narrative that is really Jimmy's story and the story of many black San Franciscans. You are not black. You're a white filmmaker. Do you feel that you're able to or how do you make sure that you're able to tell those stories responsibly?
Yeah, I think that's, a really good question. And I think I'm glad that it's becoming more of a discussion, I think, with films now, not just what's happening in front of the camera, obviously, but who's behind sort of telling these stories. I think, for us, me and Jimmy have been making movies since, we were teens, and we've been friends long before that. And so it sort of unfolded naturally just that we would make this because that was something that we'd always done.
It didn't feel at all in a way like, he's trying to help me tell my story, and I'm his friend. It never felt like he was trying to tell the story of the black experience in San Francisco. But we also grew up in the same neighborhood, so there is a lot of similar things. And it's inspired by my story and based on my story, but it is pulling a lot from, people that Joe knew and experiences he had as well.
I think, too, that, like, there are a lot of stories, even being a lifelong San Franciscan, I'm fifth generation San Franciscan, even with that, there are other stories in San Francisco that are, not stories that I think I am the right person to necessarily tell. And so I think, but even that sort of was how it began, was just sort of informally between Jimmy and I. But I think it was also important, as we kind of grew the film and we brought on more collaborators, it was important that those people also have different perspectives, and that the decision makers in this film not just be people like myself, like you said, who are white. Because I think this story was tapping into something that's happening to our city. And, I think for us, even just beyond race, it was like, me and Jimmy are both from San Francisco, so we have a very particular relationship to the city, even as different as our experiences have been mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. That's something that we spend a lot of time talking about, growing up and into now. Is like,
yeah, and as much as it's about my story, it's about the city, and we're both from the city, and we both love the city. So we're still trying to tell a story about the city as well.
I think one of the things that when we think about gentrification, and I can speak to New York specifically, but San Francisco has also obviously seen this, it feels like there's no turning back. It feels like the fabric of communities has been permanently changed, and that means both racially and economically and in a lot of other ways. What do you both see, since you're native San Franciscans and you've done this film, what do you see about the future of the city in terms of who's able to live there and who isn't?
Man, it's hard because it does seem like sometimes you're at the point of no return, but there are little pockets and there's little moments that do give you a little bit of hope, The premiere of this movie was one of them, one of those moments where you got to see a lot of people from all over the city, different parts of the city, all together in support. And the best thing about that was just them being all together. And I think it starts with unity.
Yeah. I think that every week my feelings about San Francisco shift. I think I have some weeks where I feel like it's lost and there are things that we won't get back. And yet there was something really special, like Jimmy said, about being at the Castro, one of our last like movie palaces, and it's filled to the brim with almost entirely San Francisco natives, some people we grew up with, some people we looked up to, like Danny Glover, Barry Bonds is there. And it felt like this night, like not only was it wonderful to get to like share this thing that we've been obviously working on for a long time with the city, that's about the city, but the reaction and the feeling in the room felt oddly like inspirational and hopeful. It felt like, we can, there's still enough people left to pack the Castro, and the energy in that space felt like, you know, there's still a fight to be had here. We live to fight another day.
Joe Talbot is the director of The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and Jimmy Fails is the star of the film. Thanks to you both for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Man Not. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Nowadays, your listener feedback usually comes in the form of a tweet or an email or a message on Facebook. But every once in a while, we still get a real posted letter.
This story is about one of those letters. Printed neatly, in all caps, it begins, Audie Cornish, I am an inmate in the Alabama Department of Corrections and an avid listener of NPR News. So, we got the writer on the phone. Collect call from prison. Hello, is this David Crenshaw?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Mr. Crenshaw. My name is Audie Cornish. I was the one who did the interview that you heard.
Hey, great to meet you.
Yes, great to almost meet you as well.
Yeah, I've been listening to yours for a while now.
I didn't know you could listen to the show. So tell me, like, how you guys heard this.
Oh, you know, we had an NPR station here in Alabama down toward the end of the dial. I think it's like 91, 92. You know, we listen to it all the time.
David Crenshaw has served 26 years of a 28-year sentence for attempted murder and a number of other lesser crimes. He wrote to us after hearing an interview I did with Alabama State Senator Cam Ward about the state's prison system.
People in some of these state prisons, you treat animals at your house better than that. It is a blemish in our state.
Alabama's prisons have the highest rate of inmate homicides in the country, nearly two dozen between the years of 2015 and 2017 alone. That's according to a Department of Justice report. That same report found violence had increased dramatically in recent years. It said prisons are so dangerous, there is, quote, reasonable cause to believe they violate inmates' constitutional rights.
Many are built on a warehouse mentality where you put 400 or 500 people in one big warehouse. You can't have enough officers with that kind of layout and not expect there to be some problems.
Senator Ward and I talked about what it would take to curb that violence. Plans to build more prisons, the need to fix locks and install cameras, hire more officers and pay them more. David Crenshaw, the letter writer, says the interview with Senator Ward got inmates talking because the issues Ward cited, the overcrowding, neglected buildings, Crenshaw says they were problems long before the epidemic of violence.
You know, basically the general reaction was, you know, how is that contributing to the increase in violence when, you know, our living conditions have been terrible for so many years, and throughout those years, we never just felt like our life being in danger the way it is today. You know,
today, Crenshaw says everyone feels unsafe.
Basically, everybody incarcerated feels in danger.
Overcrowding and understaffing, every system across the nation deals with that.
Charlotte Morrison is an attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative. The group has investigated allegations of abuse in Alabama's prisons for decades. It even sued the Department of Corrections.
We get letters, calls, emails every single day, 10 to 20 of them.
We asked Morrison to listen to some of our conversation with David Crenshaw and the factors that he thinks are responsible for the surge in violence. For example, the staffing issue. Crenshaw says a bigger problem is the way officers today are trained.
These officers coming in, they're not being trained, they're just thrown on the job. And many of them, being as young as they are, they're basically coming in the same mentality as a lot of the inmates. And you know, I just look at it like they're just another gang in prison, you know, because a lot of the times that they deal with situations, they deal with it violently anyway, you know.
So you got an inmate saying it feels like some of the officers end up behaving like they're in just another gang, that they have the same mentality as the inmates, a criminal mentality. Is that surprising to you?
No, I think that punitive doesn't go far enough. I think that there is a violent culture of prison management. We've talked to a dozen officers about their experience in the prisons, and they all say that they had modeling as cadets by other officers, this use of force style of management, rather than the rehabilitative management, and that was, you know, quite frankly, frightening for these officers who reported, you know, that they're not violent people. They are not going to hit somebody unless they are hit, but that the expectation is that you will embrace a use of force that is not necessary given the lack of a threat in the immediate environment.
I want to come to another idea from this inmate.
Well, once, you know, years back, we had quite a few different outlets to deal with our incarceration and, you know, work on rehabilitating ourselves so that we can return to society.
He mentions work detail, road and field work.
There were other programs, like self-help programs that was sponsored by the state. A lot of those programs have been done away with. You know, these guys being thrown up in here, they have basically nothing to do, just sitting around with idle time on their hands. And, of course, you know, the depression set in, and when the depression set in, and it always come out with a violent outcome, seems like.
What can you tell us about what kind of activities are left for Alabama inmates?
Well, at the prison that we sued, when we brought our suit in 2014, there were 1,500 people in the prison. Many people enter prison with substance abuse problems. And at St. Clair Prison, there were no drug programs, no AA or NA programs for the majority of people incarcerated there. But they really had no other programming as well. And the majority of prisoners spent their time idle in the dorms. They have no structure to their days. And the lack of staff meant that the department had abandoned most security protocols. They weren't doing bed checks. They weren't controlling movement. They're not doing contraband checks. And this led to a drug epidemic in the prison. And hundreds of prisoners then fall into debt to other prisoners. And that debt is enforced through physical and sexual violence.
What do you think about this moment? You know, for an organization like us to be getting a letter from an inmate, the New York Times, you know, received many photographs of what was going on inside the prisons. Does it speak to the fear?
Absolutely. It speaks to the fear, but it also speaks to the lack of access to the courts or to anyone else who would listen. The fact that people are going to the media, I think, just speaks to the desperation that people have in trying to get their complaints heard and these conditions acknowledged.
That's Charlotte Morrison with the Equal Justice Initiative. The inmate we spoke to, David Crenshaw, left us with a suggestion for legislators or anyone else working to reform Alabama's prisons.
To hear from the inmates, everybody that's talking about this subject, they're looking at things from their own point of view, but when is somebody going to look at it from the point of view of the inmate?
Tomorrow, we'll share that point of view with the commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections, Jeff Dunn.
We recognize that we have staff that are not abiding by our core values, and we are seeking to identify those staff and address those issues very aggressively.
Dunn has just released a new strategic plan to address the violence inside Alabama's prisons. We'll have more about that tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Eyes, passing of a healer. The name Dr. Patricia Bath is perhaps unfamiliar with you, as it was to me just a few days ago. But a colleague shared obituaries from several newspapers, and I could only be moved by the extraordinary life and achievements of Dr. Bath. She earned her medical degree from Howard University Medical School and began her internship in the neighborhood of her birth, Harlem. For most of her professional career, she worked as an ophthalmologist or eye doctor. And as a scientist, she developed techniques and equipment designed to treat and relieve glaucoma and cataract patients. In 1988, Dr. Bath invented the laser phaco probe, a device that removed cataracts and which she patented. Her work returned vision to people who were blind for decades. Why write about the life of Dr. Patricia Bath? Because she was a medical pioneer, a black doctor who brought relief and sight to people across black America and beyond. But there is another reason. Several months ago, I was told by an ophthalmologist that I had glaucoma and cataracts. I was stunned by the news. A month ago, my eyesight deteriorated so badly that I couldn't read a book or a newspaper. Thus, the news about the life and the passing of Dr. Patricia Bath naturally caught my attention. Dr. Bath reached 76 years of life before her transition. Today, I await treatment. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating. Robbing little kids for bags. Till an old man got behind our ass. So we speeded up the pace. Took a look back, and he was right before our face. He'd be in for a squabble, no doubt. So I swung and hit the nigga in his mouth. He was going down, we figured. But this wasn't no ordinary nigga. He stood about 6 or 7 feet. Now that's the nigga I be seeing in my sleep.
Bushwick Bill of the Houston rap group Ghetto Boys has died at age 52.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating. Robbing little kids for bags.
Bushwick Bill was born Richard Shaw in Kingston, Jamaica. His family moved to the Bushwick section of Brooklyn when he was a kid, but Houston, Texas is where he became a ghetto boy, joining Willie D and Scarface to become pioneers of gangster rap. He told his fans that he had pancreatic cancer just last month. Now, to talk about Bushwick Bill and his legacy is NPR's Rodney Carmichael. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Audie.
Tell us about Bushwick Bill as a rapper.
Well, Bushwick Bill, he was a vivid storyteller and really one of the most charismatic figures in hip hop. He ended up getting into rap almost by accident. And really now he deserves probably more credit than just about anybody for popularizing Southern rap and especially horrorcore.
Horrorcore. Okay, tell me a little bit about that, because that came around, what, the late 80s?
Yeah, so horrorcore was basically like this offshoot of gangster rap, you know, these really graphic descriptions of murder and mutilation, often of women. But Bushwick was also a guy who'd actually been studying to become a missionary and a minister before all of this. Then there's the fact that he was a little person with a disability that really made him an outcast and made his own life pretty horrific in some ways.
You can hear that in some of his classic verses, right, from the Ghetto Boys song, Mind Playing Tricks on Me.
But this wasn't no ordinary man. He stood about 6 or 7 feet. Now that's the creep I be seeing in my sleep.
Rodney, you know, people look back at this song now and they talk about it as one that tells the story of someone suffering from trauma, right? Someone who lives a violent life. Can you talk about how this played out in his music?
Well, you know, violence and trauma was a world that Bushwick was not, you know, afraid to deal with. And it wasn't always fictional. You know, one of the heaviest songs on his debut album, Little Big Man, it basically lays out a real life event where Bushwick lost his eye to a gunshot during an argument with his girlfriend. And he even ends up being declared dead before coming back to life when this happens. And he was drunk on Everclear at the time, he says in the song, and that inspired the song's title, which was Ever So Clear, which really ends up being this clear-eyed, really confessional song of enlightenment for Bushwick.
See, most of my life I never had this. I felt like an outcast, treated like a misfit. Damn near didn't make it on my day of birth. Thinking, was I really supposed to be on this planet Earth? I take a deep breath and then another follows. Cause hardship is kind of hard to swallow. See, it's rough.
I know it's a long way from his early days of studying religion, but toward the end of his life and career, what kind of music was he doing?
Well, you know, Bushwick made the classic 360-degree circle in his life and time. And he really ended up returning back to his roots and to Christianity. He got born again, and he was really making music that was a lot closer to gospel in his later years. Very uplifting music.
This is real talk. I'm on a righteous walk. Left the dark, now I'm shining my light like Louis the Lightning Bug. You can call me a thug, a true homie unto God. Till the rapture comes, I'm back to song.
But it wasn't the type of thing where he totally disowned what he had done in the past. He had unique ways of being able to mesh together all of the routes his life had taken into one big story that he felt like was made him a witness and an inspiration for a lot of people.
That's NPR's Rodney Carmichael talking to us about the legacy of Bushwick Bill of the Ghetto Boys. Bill died at the age of 52.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Black men in America live on average 72 years. That is 4 years less than white men. Now, a growing body of research suggests there may be a way to change that. But the solution raises difficult questions for a society that dreams of being colorblind. NPR's Shankar Vedantam reports.
Every so often, Marlon Wade likes to head over to his local barbershop, Wrist Action. He doesn't come for a cut.
No hair, no hair. I just wear the bald head.
He comes to shoot the breeze. Wade likes to hang out with people who know and understand him. Some years ago, when he was in the market for a new doctor, he looked for that same feeling of connection.
I had various choices. I had over 20 doctors to choose from.
But one stood out. She was, like him, Black, and like him, a practicing Muslim.
She gets me, I get her. We talk about life, we talk about our religion. You know, if something wrong with me, she's going to let me know.
While Wade has a trusting relationship with his doctor, many Black men in America do not. Their reluctance to seek out preventative health care lowers the odds they will survive diseases like prostate cancer.
It's not just prostate cancer, it's cardiovascular disease, it's stroke, it's diabetes. Most of the death is due to preventable or chronic conditions.
Owen Garrick is a doctor and researcher. He wondered what it would take to persuade Black men to accept preventative care. He and his colleagues, Marcella Alshon and Grant Graziani, had a hunch that the race of the doctor might be a factor. So they ran a field study to try to answer one simple question.
Will Black men take more preventative care services if they're randomly assigned to a Black doctor?
The researchers randomly assigned 600 Black men to see a Black or non-Black doctor at a clinic. All the doctors recommended several health screenings.
The Black doctors were able to convince more effectively the patients to take more of the preventative services.
And not by a little, by a lot. Black doctors were about 50% more effective than non-Black doctors at getting Black men to get a flu shot and have a blood test for diabetes. They were even more successful at convincing patients to get blood drawn for a cholesterol screening.
There was a 72% difference in the ability of the Black doctor to recommend and have the Black male patient take cholesterol screening compared to the non-Black doctor.
If all African-American men were to respond like those in the study, Garrick says racial gaps in cardiovascular disease outcomes might shrink by nearly 20%. Why were the Black doctors more effective? Garrick thinks the data offer a clue.
We found that the Black doctors actually wrote more notes compared to the non-Black doctors about their patients. And often those notes talked about their non-healthcare issues. A wedding is coming up. Will the Warriors repeat as NBA champions? So non-medical issues.
In other words, these doctors were making a connection with patients. It's like what Marlon Wade from the barbershop said about his doctor. They talk about life, about religion. He gets her, she gets him. All this might be true for more than just Black patients. In a follow-up study, Garrick found that large majorities of Black and white patients said they'd be better understood by a physician of the same race. The research is part of a growing body of work that asks whether matching people by race, gender, or religion makes a difference. In another study, researchers found that Florida patients assigned to physicians of their own race were 13% less likely to die while in the hospital. The results were driven almost entirely by Black patients matched with Black physicians. Studies in other fields echo the same results. Education researcher Constance Lindsay and her colleagues reviewed data from 11,000 students in Tennessee. They found that when Black students had early interactions with Black teachers, there was a lasting effect.
Black students who were matched to a Black teacher were less likely to drop out of high school, more likely to sit for a college entrance exam. So think, you know, SAT, ACT, and then more likely to enroll in college.
These studies present a difficult quandary for policymakers, particularly given our painful history of racial segregation. I raised this issue with Constance Lindsay. Let's say you're the principal of a school and you have one Black teacher in second grade and you have, let's say, 15 Black students spread across five sections of second grade. Mm-hmm. Would you assign all those 15 students to the Black teacher?
I probably would not do that. If I had students that in that particular set of 15 that were particularly disadvantaged, I might. I might also explore ways in which teachers could co-teach, but I definitely wouldn't advocate sort of segregating them into one class.
I guess what I'm asking you is, you know, if you looked at the data and said that you are improving the odds of students by 10, 15, maybe 20%, and you did not do that thing that could improve their odds by 10, 15, 20%, I mean, that is immoral.
You could say that. I mean, if I were a parent of a Black boy and there was one Black male teacher in the school, I would go tell the principal to assign my child to him.
There are three lessons from this work. The first is that we really need doctors and teachers from different races and different backgrounds. The second lesson is that if we want to be understood by people who are different from us in some way, it's going to take work. You can't just assume that your job begins and ends with teaching a course or diagnosing a patient. You have to make a connection with the person across from you. The final lesson has to do with the seemingly contradictory effects of diversity. Other research has shown that diversity boosts creativity and innovation. Here we've looked at how connecting with people who are like us can produce better outcomes. One explanation for this seeming contradiction lies in what you are trying to achieve. Novelty and creativity might flourish from bringing together different perspectives, but trust might come a little easier when we have things in common. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
You can hear more of Shankar's reporting on this subject on the podcast Hidden Brain.
Racial bias in the criminal justice system has become a national concern. Activists and even some elected officials have been pressing to find ways to eliminate or reduce disparities in everything from the use of force to sentencing decisions. Now the District Attorney of San Francisco has announced a new approach to eliminating racial bias in charging decisions. The DA's office will use technology intended to remove the potential for implicit biases when prosecutors first review a case. We're joined now by San Francisco's District Attorney, George Gascon. Welcome. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So I understand that the idea for this came from a 2017 study, which was commissioned by the district attorney, which found, quote, substantial racial and ethnic disparities in criminal justice outcomes. So then what gave you the idea for this technology tool, for this tool? It was developed, as I understand it, with the help of Stanford's Computational Policy Lab.
Right. So when I first became DA in 2011, one of the concerns that I had was I wanted to understand to what level, if any, the work that we were doing in the DA's office was compromising the purity of the work by filtering implicit bias into our work. We tried really hard, obviously, not to have explicit bias, but implicit is more complicated, as you know, because it's part of the socialization process, and whatever your behavior is, you're not really seeing it. So we brought in researchers to help us first look at our work in general terms and see whether there was anything that we could do in order to reduce the disproportionality on our work when it came to dealing with racial minorities and to ensure that we were not treating people disparately.
So let me just be clear about this. As I understand it, if you use this technology on a police report, it will redact information about the race of the people involved. It'll get rid of the names of the officers, witnesses, and suspects. And it eliminates references to locations and neighborhoods that could suggest somebody's race. So how does this work?
Right. So what you have is you have basically artificial intelligence that has been trained to do a natural language search. First of all, go through all the face sheets of the reports and redact anything that has to do with race, hair color, eye colors, you know, those things that normally would be identified with a particular race. Also names, because sometimes they can be, and locations where the location is just simply the location where the incident occurred. Then it goes into the actual narrative, and again, using natural language search, goes through it and removes all the things that could be either racial identifiers or proxies for racial identifiers. The prosecutor then makes an assessment based on the facts that are being described, whether we have a prosecutable case. They'll say yes or no. And then they go into the second level of review, and that's when you start looking at descriptors. So you may see video, you may see a bunch of other things now that clearly are going to tell you what the race of the person is. But now you made your first decision. Now you look at it, and then you confirm whether you still are going to go through with your original decision. Mm.
So how are your prosecutors responding to this? And I'm also curious, because you have, as many people may know, you have a very unique profile. I mean, you are believed to be the first former police chief to become a district attorney. So I'm curious about how your prosecutors are reacting to this and how the police department is reacting to this.
Right now, the police, I can't tell you for sure. I can tell you as to my prosecutors, what we did is we took the supervisors and the people involved in our charging decisions, and they actually helped us work the system. So the process that we have created actually was a collaboration with people in my office. So they are supportive and they're intrigued by what it's just going to look like. Again, we want to make sure that there are no negative unintended consequences to this, so we're going to be looking at it very closely. We are working with the Stanford people to make sure that we create the right metrics. You know, the goal here is to do something that will do the right things, and part of that will be learning and seeing if there are any negative unintended consequences that we want to go back and fix them very quickly.
That is George Gascon. He is the district attorney for the city and county of San Francisco. George Gascon, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Michelle.
You know what? You know how I can tell? You know how I can genuinely tell that those, a lot of those fans are just bandwagon fans? Because just a few years prior, a lot of these white folks weren't rooting for the Celtics because the league was too black. They stayed away.
It's turning off a lot of white customers that are coming to the game, you know?
Why?
I think there's still there's a conflict between the white and the black, and I don't enjoy going to the basketball and seeing all black players.
This man is one of the great players in New York City history, for sure, in the rich history of New York City basketball. And he starred at LaSalle, actually first from Queensbridge, Queens, and also, which is out in Long Island City. Started LaSalle Academy, led them to a 1997 Catholic High School Athletic Association title in 1997. Then went on to start St. John's, leading St. John's in 1999 to the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. Moved on, drafted in the first round, 16 overall by the Chicago Bulls in 99. Turned out to be one of the most fearless, one of the most aggressive defensive players in the history of the game, and he turned out to be an all-star in 2004, and that same year was the NBA Defensive Player of the Year 2004, and then he went on to win the title, the NBA championship with the Los Angeles Lakers in 2010, and this gentleman has really been a great inspiration to society on hitting on the issues of mental illness and really being able to help people understand that and be able to help people be aware of it. It is our pleasure to have this gentleman who has a film out, Showtime, documentary called Quiet Storm, the Ron Artest story. It's our pleasure to have Mr. Meta World Peace, who was born as Ron Artest, but Meta World Peace is what he goes by right now, and it's our pleasure to have him on. How are you, Meta?
Everything's good, man. Thanks for the great introduction, and everything is solid. You know, just kind of going on this world, well, actually the regional tour, in terms of physically doing interviews for the documentary, but national tour with media, over the phone interviews, some Skype. So it's going well.
Your NBA career, you mentioned, it was interesting, you mentioned the incident in Detroit, the Malice in the Palace or whatever. And you mentioned, I never really heard you say that before, that you really thought it negatively affected the rest of your career. Like what? Like in what way? Like what way do you think it took away from your career?
Yeah, you know, just I would say just the I just didn't really want to play anymore. That was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't really training. Like I was off a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, training, like running on the treadmill. I think Jay-Z said it in the verse, running on the treadmill, going over fast or something like that.
Right.
You know, I was training, but you know, I have a whole year.
Right.
So you get distracted a little bit.
Right.
Well, and now situation involving a spectator and a player, game 3, NBA Finals. A couple of nights ago, Kyle Lowry was diving for a loose ball. A fan got involved, put his hands on Lowry. What was your take on that moment, and did you think the fan was rightfully disciplined? Well, not fan, but fan and investor of the Warriors.
Yeah.
But what was your take of that situation?
I mean, I think, for one, like I wasn't preparing to my situation until I read the Instagram post for Undisputed. My buddy Undisputed had a little Instagram post that said Metal lost $5 million and somebody was in 100, you know, finding the gentleman like $500,000. It's like somebody that's worth $100,000 losing $22 or something like that.
Right.
You know, so I mean, for my suspension, I'm not saying like do what you did to me to him. That's not what I'm saying, but my suspension was way more severe. Like I lost the capital for the year, and then I lost every single one of my endorsement deals, and then I lost all my commercials. So it was well north of $5 million when you look at everything in total. So I mean, I think the guy obviously had a little issue. So I think he should get some community service. I think community service and some type of anger management support to some institutions would be really cool. And I think no box seats, no front row seats, no box seats. Just they sit with the crowd.
Right.
I personally wouldn't even ban them. I would just let them come to the game. The ban is easy, I think.
Right.
You know, because like he don't have to face nobody. Mm-hmm. I think sitting in with the fans would be like. Cause I think even the home fans would be pretty upset. So I think community service. You know, it'll be because community service is annoying, man. How much money you got, man?
Right.
Community services, I did community service, and I was like, it was painful,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, so I think something like that. Because even if you lose $20 million, $500,000 is not even a lot to somebody worth $5 million. And if you worth $5 million, you lose $500,000, you're gonna lose sleep like a week. You still got 4.5.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So you're not even tripping like that. You know, so even if you find them $20 million, that's now it's ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? So the money's not really a factor here.
Maybe the money going to organizations,
right.
You know, like for community, for the Oakland community, the kids and things like that. That
then
I remember that was suggested.
Then it's going to get political. Then it's going to get political. Like I just feel like, you know, it's like when I lost my money, they took my money and gave it to United Health. Way on the United America.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I didn't even have no say so.
Even
though I heard that company's a good company, but I would have put the money in Queensbridge.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And now you're playing with other people's money. You know what I'm saying? So I think that just gets tricky. You know what I'm saying? I think like people can put their money where they want. I think the community service is even better because your time is, you know, is more than money. You know, that's like when I go to my neighborhood. You know, I never had to pay anybody to anything for respect, whatever. It's the time. It's the love. It's the time. You know, and I think his time is more valuable, is just better spent doing community service in the neighborhood. That might be kind of cool. I don't think you necessarily need the money. Money never changes anything. Sometimes it does, but you know, you can throw money at people and they don't change them.
Right.
It actually enables them sometimes. Maybe him teaching people what he knows. About business, that might even be bigger.
Yes,
that's an
excellent idea.
That's a good community.
That's a great
community service right there.
Right,
no question.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 15, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have questions, counter-racist suggestions, thoughts you would like to share. The number 605-313 5164, the code 564943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before, or several things. List just kept getting longer and longer as I was waiting to share. First, we are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged for all the folks who have chipped in on PayPal for a decade. That is why we have remained on air. Hope the cows has provided accurate information on what it means to be white, what white supremacy racism is, constructive tips, strategies on things that victims of racism can do to solve this problem as soon as possible. If you are not into PayPal, you can drop me an email. We'll get you a physical address, physical mailing address. Again, much obliged to all the folks who have invested. You can also visit my wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. It's linked at my blog. Feel free to browse the list. Much gratitude to all of the investors who for 10 years have nabbed items and helped keep us on the airwaves. Let's see. Start going down my list of items. Number one, Father's Day. So I've been told that's supposed to be coming up tomorrow. I do not have offspring, but to the attempted counter-racist fathers listening in, keep up the constructive effort. I know it is challenging. Do your best. Hopefully you'll have a constructive day tomorrow. I will repeat what I said when it was so-called Mother's Day. If you might be in a tendency, it's great if you have a so-called father, parent that you want to show some gratitude for and, you know, get them a meal or whatever it is. If you end up spending a lot of coins, it's probably just going to further finance white supremacy racism. Going out to spend a lot of money, invariably that money is going to come back to whites. If you're going to buy something, try to support a black-owned business, or minimize your spending. Maybe you can go and invest time. That was what Ron Artest just said. Instead of the money, you can go and invest time. You all can hang out the whole day, and you can prepare a meal for them and hang out or do some things around the house, like something that does not involve having to put a lot of money into white people's pockets to show appreciation for your so-called father. That would be awesome to keep in mind. Next, the segment about Bushwick Bill passing at 52, prostate cancer, that's what they said, racism, white supremacy, really, but in the form of prostate cancer is what they said. I was stunned by that because we just had the report, I believe it was last week, where they were doing the analysis of the song from the Ghetto Boys, Mind Playing Tricks on Me, and dealing with mental illness among black people, victims of racism. They were just talking about that and the influence of that song. And then literally a week later, they're, you know, paying their respects. It was staggering a little bit. And then at 52, that's another one. Point that out regularly. They had the segment about the low number of years that black males can expect to be around. They exclusively black males, and Bushwick Bill dead at 52. I would almost insert that might be an example of black male privilege, but I feel it's such a tragic situation. Talk about the importance of health on a regular basis. The system of white supremacy, that is exactly exactly what is supposed to happen. That is the design of racists. Black people being in poor health and checking out of here way before 72, if we have anything to say about it. Michael Jackson didn't even get to 52. I don't think Prince got to 52 either. That's what we have in mind. Not hanging out. Mr. Fuller almost closing in on 90. That's not the plan at all. In fact, that should even be more questions. People asking Mr. Fuller, what exactly have you been eating and doing to take care of yourself to hang out and share your views on white supremacy racism for so long? And Matt, just think about that. If Mr. Fuller had, you know, not been able to stay around for so long, how many people and how much work, like the edit on his book and the code book, I think, was published in 2011. If, you know, he had not been able to stay around so long, the amount of counter-racist work he would not have been able to get done. Bushwick Bill, maybe at 55, that's when he would have, oh, wow, this racism, white supremacy thing is a problem. That's been the problem the whole time. I'm going to dedicate, you know, the remainder of my life to addressing that. Maybe that's what would have happened. Same thing for Prince. Same thing for Michael Jackson. Taking care of ourselves as best we can in a system that is designed to destroy our health and quality of life. That is a major aspect of counter-racism. Didn't even finish with the Bushwick Bill segment. Gratitude to Thomas in New York. We just had that segment, I think it was last week, about the Ghetto Boys and mental illness. Thomas in New York said they played the edited version of the song when they were doing the analysis, and he said that that doesn't really convey authentically everything that's being expressed in the song. When you play the edited version, you're losing a lot. And they did the same thing when they played the song right there. It's a big difference when you hear the authentic version of the song and it's "This Wasn't No Ordinary Nigger." Stood about 6 or 7 feet. That's the nigger I be seeing in my sleep. Now we get back to the mental illness, and why would it be a nigger? In a system of racism, white supremacy, no dreams about a white man doing the stalking, a white man or a white woman causing the problem, even in our dreams, even, you know, in mental illness. It's another black person that we're fighting with. Even that is fascinating aspect to discuss, but that is lost when you get the edited version. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Next. Ava DuVernay's documentary continues. They said the most popular thing watched on Netflix. I have access to Netflix and have not even attempted to watch this series. In fact, I haven't looked at anything on Netflix, I think, in about 2 months. Not that I'm bragging, just statement of fact. Some folks might view that as lazy. Gus T, you should have watched this docu-series, and then you could have written or reported or given a counter-racist perspective. So maybe I'm being shiftless and lazy and not watching this, but I have not watched it. I have no intention of watching it anytime soon. Maybe I'll watch. It's like 5 hours, though. I have no intention of watching this. I don't care what's in it. If you all have seen it and have a thought on it, grand. My initial view on this that I've already articulated was I'm not enthused. Even though this is a victim of white supremacy, important case, I am not enthused about going to sit and watch 5 hours of black people being abused. I've said I don't do slave flicks anymore. I don't do any of the plantation stuff. I haven't seen Get Out. I haven't seen Black Panther. No intention of seeing any of those films. I didn't see Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's project, Cowbell. Didn't see that either. No intention of seeing this. Black people are brutalized all the time. I'm just not going to be so excited to go see a film where it's going to, oh, yes, and more black people being mistreated and abused, falsely incarcerated, accused of rape. Yes, that is how I want to invest 5 hours of my Saturday evening. So that was my initial stance. However, having watched over the last 2 months what has unfolded, they had the white woman who her publisher dropped her. And then this week they had Elizabeth Lederer, the former prosecutor. She stepped down from Columbia Law School. And I point out those illustrations. One could say that this film has caused suspected race soldiers some problems. maybe cost them a little bit of income, maybe caused them to have to use some of their time and energy that they could have been practicing racism. Now they've had to be on the defensive. I'm not a racist, and talking about this film. So maybe there's been constructive value to this project, right? Maybe I should watch the film. Maybe I would, you know, be more informed about why these folks have stepped down. I believe Ms. Lederer, she did get a space in the New York Times, an op-ed they call it, to defend herself. That is not privilege. That is a powerful white woman. I don't think the New York Times offers space to just anyone who has a gripe or grievance to give them that sort of global platform to come out and say what you want about the film or your character and how it's been besmirched. I think that term has some racist connotations. I will retract that my reputation has been attacked unjustly, calling me a racist and what have you. But if folks have seen that film, if you have comments or even if you have thoughts about, you know, hey, I think this is constructive. It seems like it might be causing some suspected racist problems. Feel free. I did have one victim of racism, a Cows listener. She saw the film. She thought it was significant that there are a lot of black people in conflict with other black people in this film. Not that that's not true. That does happen in the system. However, that's not the main point of this conflict. Black people fussing with other black people, or it shouldn't be. She said that was one. And she said, two, that one of the young children, there's focus on his sibling being transgender. Having a sibling, I believe, that was biologically born male. And then gender fluidity that was addressed became identifying as a female. And that became a part of the documentary. My familiarity, that generally is not something that I have heard really ever when people talk about the Central Park Five. That seems very tangential to me. And maybe I might say that's the sort of thing that seems like evidence of racist interference, perhaps. And, you know, you got to get a little bit of this in, got to get a little bit of this in if we're going to publish this and, you know, talk bad about, you know, some of these suspected racists. We got to, you know, balance that out a little bit. Seems like that could be the case. I could be in error. I have not seen this project. And as I said, have no plan to. Next. On Wednesday, it's like we'll be having two sections of workplace racism for this week. Dr. Joy DeGruy should be on the program Wednesday. I think that's the 19th. I don't have a calendar directly in front of me. It's the 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I specifically wanted to get her thoughts on things that black people can and should do to bolster confidence in the workplace, because we've heard that from a lot of folks being on jobs where white people are doing things to what they call second guess your work or suggest that you don't know what you're talking about. You've made all these errors, and often that's not the case. But the end result is that the non-white person ends up thinking, wow, maybe I don't know my job as well. Maybe I'm not as competent as I thought I was, and just losing some of that black self-respect confidence to ask her some of the things that we can do to maintain, replenish that confidence in a workplace setting or school setting. And then also in terms of getting frustrated, depressed on the job, if she has tips in the moment, and then long-term strategies to combat being depressed and burnt out, as they say, in the workplace. But Dr. Joy DeGruy, she's been on the I believe this will be her fourth visit. She's in the Hidden Colors documentary series, and she wrote the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. But it should be Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The segment on the life expectancy for black males and what can be done to solve that problem. I would, in my view, that sort of report is not authentic, because you can't have a segment talking about how low the number of years are for black male life expectancy without really, in my view, centering on white supremacy racism as being the culprit, racists being responsible for why that number if so low? That's what one would expect in a system of white supremacy, right? Not mentioning, and again, the Coon Man is so many angles if we're going to talk about workplace racism and why a black patient would be more comfortable with a black doctor. This is the year of the Coon Man. The University of Virginia is NCAA champions, for goodness sake. How does that not get mentioned in context for why these problems are occurring? Sloppy journalism or further support of racism, white supremacy, could be both. Take your pick. Next. Even before I progress, they had a similar segment talking in an incorrect manner, pussyfooting white supremacy, racism previously, health racism. And they also talked about it's effective if black patients see a black doctor. And they went even further this week to the classroom and teachers and all of that. I said again, white people are not ignorant about this. They've known this for a long time. Back in the time of eugenics, they employed the same strategy. We don't want to have white doctors come out and tell black people don't have too many babies. We'll get black people to do it. They already know this. Two, if this is being greatly talked about or talked about more frequently now, need to have more black doctors, need to have more black doctors, need to have more black doctors. I would at least have a question, because they said in that report that question everything. Mr. Fuller says that, and I saw that twice in two different contexts over the last 24 hours. Question everything. Question everything. We need more black doctors. We need more black doctors. And again, it's not even being directly tied to white supremacy racism. You don't want to see the Coon Man. But if it's we need more black doctors because they can be successful in getting you to take the flu shot, question everything. I am not a doctor. I am not going to profess to be an expert on flu shots, but I do not get enthused about those either. Netflix offerings or flu shots. And if it's the doctor is going to come and get try to get me enthused about something that I would not do for a white doctor, then question everything. Let's see. They compared, I'm going backwards, the Ava DuVernay, her documentary or docudrama, excuse me, docuseries. It's not even not a documentary, her drama on the Central Park Five. They compared it to the series on R. Kelly. That's that moron says every compensatory call in. No metaphors, consistently says that one of the ways the system of white supremacy works is using metaphors, analogies, comparisons. They will take two concepts and say, oh, look at here, the same thing. Ava DuVernay's docuseries and the project on R. Kelly. Now, I didn't see that either. Having not seen either of these films, I can just stop immediately and say, no, these are not the same at all. The Central Park Five case, you have already had DNA scientific conclusive evidence. These black children did not rape this white woman. That is not the case with R. Kelly. It doesn't matter what you think about whether he is innocent or guilty. They do not, at this juncture, 2019, June 15th, have scientific genetic proof on his innocence or guilt with regards to anything that he has been charged. That's a huge one. This is not the same to compare these two cases at all. And even the fact that this case has already been adjudicated. Nothing is going back to court. There's no new evidence to rehash. If anything, it's just what do we think about the people involved in this? That's all this is in this drama. They already have a documentary that came out years ago. You can go back and read the transcripts from the court trial. All of this is what they might say is rehash, which I don't have a problem with because it seems a lot of people, this is new information. No problem. The R. Kelly thing, this is supposed to be going to trial. This is the sort of thing that people would normally say, whoa, we might be prejudicing the jury or potential jurors to have something in the what they call court of public opinion before this is even going to be formally adjudicated. Not comparable at all. In my opinion, I could be in error. This sort of thing happens on a regular basis. That's why I encourage on the compensatory call-in if we could not use metaphors. if we could be direct, explicit to what we would like to say. In my view, suspected racists do that sort of thing regularly. That is a standard operating practice of master deceivers, whites, non-white people, myself included. We've been exposed to this conduct for a long time, and we are still learning. Sometimes we don't have evidence to support our viewpoint, which is fine. That's me too sometimes. But we'll substitute and insert an analogy, metaphor of some sort frequently that just adds to the confusion. If we could be direct, explicit with what we are attempting to say, that would be grand. I will prompt about the metaphors. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, I'll get in one more, sorry. If we have any folks who have military experience, we did have a question for workplace racism. I do not have military experience. Person was asking for suggestions. So if we have any folks who have military experience with us today, it would be awesome. If you are not a spectator, if you have thoughts on how to deal with a sergeant or higher ranking personnel making racist derogatory remarks towards you, how you would deal with that sort of thing while you are in the armed services, that would be great from someone who has direct experience in that field. Much obliged. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be grand. Try to be mindful that there is no background noise. If other folks are being loud or talking, whatever it is, maybe they're watching television, if you could kind of get to a quiet area, that would be great. Use your 5 minutes. Also, if you could use your mute button, if you know it is noisy, just helps to preserve the quality of the broadcast. Myself and others don't have to compete with unnecessary disruptions in the background. Thank you kindly. You can just unmute when you are ready to speak again. We should have ample time if you have additional comments to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can you hear me?
Greetings, Jay in St. Louis. Yes, sir.
I wanted to offer some direct experience as far as being in the military. If you're dealing with a supervisor who is using racial terminology, are they calling the individual themselves racial names?
Let's see. Called him a boy repeatedly. He gave a one situation. He asked him, "Where is your?" Was blacking up. And the victim kept saying, "I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means." And so this kept going back and forth. And he says, "You're a dumb black MF-er. It's lotion. You're so ashy. You're almost a white man." That sort of direct racist language. That was one illustration and additional types of exchanges like that.
Okay. So in that situation, I would utilize what they call the chain of command. I would not go all the way to the top of it. What I would do is try to first go directly above that sergeant. That's just one person. So in this case, if it's a sergeant, you can go to either an enlisted personnel who is actually ranked higher, or you can go to a commissioned officer. If you run across a commissioned officer and you let them know things like that, usually they will direct you to the policy where you can get that taken care of pretty quickly, because that's absolutely unacceptable. I also wanted
I'll give you extra time. Just what would you be concerned, because he did write in the letter in terms of going up what they call the chain of command, going to someone who has more power, about possible retaliation from others or people hearing about this, comrades, I guess, hearing about this and, oh, you went and snitched and that sort of thing. Would you expect any retaliation from the folks that you have to work with?
I would. If you have to expect retaliation, it comes. It's a part of it. That's why I advise not to go directly to the top of that chain of command. It can be viewed as very disruptive. So you want to be very cautious with the way you deal with this. So my initial recommendation is just to go to the top, just a little bit higher, to someone with more power first. So that way, if things don't bear out, then you can justifiably take it even higher. And so I would keep utilizing that chain as much as possible. But as far as dealing with retaliation, I would always emphasize the professionalism that's supposed to be within the military services, what the institutions themselves declare in all of their manuals. I don't care which service it is. They all have manuals. It's called standards of conduct and codes of conduct. None of that behavior is captured by what they describe in that. So that type of professionalism, I think, is going to provide the space for that individual to be able to deal with the retaliation in a smart way.
Much obliged, sir.
What did I want to speak about? I did want to speak about the Ava DuVernay work that's on Netflix. I as well did not watch it. I'm not going to watch it. I have watched other series of hers. I think she's a very talented. I think she's a very talented artist, but I don't think I'm very suspicious of the significance and the symbolism that comes along with these kinds of portrayals, especially when it comes close to election year. I think it acts as an outlet, and I don't think it's a constructive one, because a lot of times by the end, after all of that drama and pain, where it's aimed at is something very minuscule. So the firings and the spotlight on the former prosecutors has been unexpected, and it's been very entertaining to watch to me. But I don't think it's something we can count on things like media products to do for us on a regular basis when they're sponsored through the institutions that Ms. DuVernay uses to create her art, you know, regardless of her being a talented artist. I also wanted to speak about the ability of black doctors to be able to communicate information to black patients. I think this is a very dynamic attribute, given our social conditions and white supremacy. And I think we have to look at it that way. So I think the question you brought up was very important. How can this be used to in ways against us? So I was thinking specifically about the Tuskegee experiment and the different ways where state government can cloak itself in racial interpreters, kinds of interpreters, people they hire, other black people, and get black people to do things like the report was saying. That can be a good thing, and that can also be a bad thing. So I'm not sure how to look at it, but I do think it's something we have to look at as a kind of dynamic attribute, something that's not necessarily good. I think it's easy for us to get caught up in the symbolism of that, and I don't think that's wise at all. There's one other thing I wanted to speak about. I'm forgetting it right now, so I'll just pause and wait for somebody else to speak. Thanks.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. I had one other point I wanted to make about the comparison between Ava DuVernay's project and the R. Kelly film, whatever it was, that was out earlier this year. No one is facing criminal charges. None of these white women, Elizabeth Lederer and Miss Fairstein, I think that's the white woman who was dropped from her publisher, none of them are facing criminal charges as a result of this. They, you know, resigned or whatever. Again, white people don't get fired. They get transferred. R. Kelly is facing criminal charges, they say, as a result of pressure from this film. That is a substantial difference. A white person losing a job, facing criminal charges. Not the same thing in my view either. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard? May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. I will say about the docuseries, When They See Us, if you already know about the story, I think it would be best to just, you know, not watch it. It is very visually traumatizing, but I do agree that Ms. DuVernay, she does have a really good ability of directing and, you know, putting things together, which, you know, I can't commend her for that. But just, you know, just like was mentioned, I'm not sure what the full, you know, reason for the docuseries was. And, you know, I am kind of have concerns about when you have like a docuseries or a docudrama, it basically allows for artistic freedom, which it's kind of like how the artistic freedom is used can just further the system, aid in the system of racism and white supremacy. The other thing I'll just mention quickly is that I was really intrigued by the segment from last week about the book by Josh Levin, The Queen, speaking about Linda Taylor, the example of the original welfare queen, or she was the original welfare queen. So I got the book on audiobook, and I'm only a few chapters in, but it seems like it's also very, I guess it's not what I thought it would be. It seems like it speaks, some parts of it, it speaks more about like the white men involved with the case, because there was a case against her, rather than, you know, him, rather than the author starting out about her life, which is what the NPR segment basically, that's what he was discussing, how she was also like a victim because of her upbringing in the South. And within the first few chapters, he still hasn't gotten to that. So hopefully I'll be able to finish it within the next week or so, and I'll be able to give a update of my opinion of the book. But I guess so far it at least has really given a lot of detail about, you know, the case, and then also basically how white men was able to use her to either further their political career, because he talks about Ronald Reagan, or he talks about this reporter. I think his last name is Bliss, if I'm not mistaken, and how he was basically able to use her to further his career within journalism. So I'll just leave it there. And thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. Reading is more important than watching television. Give us the update. I do remember that segment. It was interesting because they were talking about how she was kind of racially ambiguous, and she was non-white and was greatly victimized growing up, and just was trying as best she could to get through. That is, give us the update. Let us know if it's worth the read, what sort of information you find as you keep digging through it. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you so far, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
Let's see. I heard both of you. We'll get retired firefighter first, and then we'll get Big Victim.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody. I'll just start off with Renthal James Simpson. The only reason why I'm mentioning his name, because of white people. They decided to have something called a 25-year anniversary of the issues that about the murder of his white female suspected racist wife and white male friend. And the only thing I have on that is white people created the National quote unquote image of the person that is named Arenthal James Simpson, starting somewhere around his junior and senior year at USC. As some of us may know, the graduates of the University of Southern California ends up being administrators in Hollywood. He made billions of dollars for white people. And whatever took place from that fame and fortune that he had, whatever they criticized as being incorrect, white people played a big participation in that particular part as far as with their advertisement and whatnot, that sort of thing. Going on to the DCS program, today was rather interesting. I didn't bring it up, but somebody brought up the idea to have the younger black males to stand up and to confess about the great deeds of their fathers, being that I believe tomorrow is so-called Father's Day. Immediately, and I'm talking about some of the youngest of the boys, I'm talking about 7 and 8 years old, approached me. I was sitting away from it as they were doing this in this group, this large group. And some of the 7 and 8 year olds came to me one by one and stating that Mr. Imani, I don't have a dad. My dad didn't do anything for me at all, you know, which is a reality, truth be told, which is a reality under the system of racism, white supremacy. And basically, they was looking for some sort of advice for me. I said, well, you don't have to stand up and state anything at all. But if you do want to state anything, tell everybody else that, you know, and basically there would be no need for anything close to a program where males are older males as well as younger males are relating and conversing and doing things in the most constructive manner they could together. It would be no need for it if there was some sort of proficiency with non-white black people under the global system of racism, white supremacy. There would be no need for it as far as a mentoring program is concerned. And it's obvious perhaps on why a lot of the quote-unquote attempted mothers, black mothers, send their boys to us. Moving on, Central Park 5, I saw the movie, based on so many people that I converse with, including the other person that's under the same roof with me. I wasn't excited about it at all, and even from watching the entire thing, I wasn't excited about it at all. It was nothing that I was surprised about. One thing about movies, as most of us would know, there's a lot of fiction that's involved into movies that are quote-unquote based on truth, which I don't like and appreciate at all. I don't need it in order to sit down and watch something. And on top of that, the five black males, there was probably something that actually took place during that period of time that they would be anxious to let everybody know about. There was some a news story came out about them gaining millions of dollars in, a lawsuit involved. And somebody posted it on their Facebook, a guy that I grew up with, and I stated, well, I know it wouldn't be a long line of people that'd be willing to go through the terror that they went through during those. I think two of them did 5 years, one of them did 5.5 years, one did 6 years, and one that wasn't even originally arrested did 12 years in adult prison. You know, and I said the only adequate compensation they can incur is the total neutralization of the global system of racism, white supremacy, and replacing it with justice. That's the only compensation that would be adequate to something that they went through, not something that's called money. Moving on, last but not least, I'm watching for the second time because it was so interesting, and I think it's something that probably, if you are going to watch television, something that'll be interesting. It's a documentary. That doesn't mean that everything about it is 100% fact, but nevertheless, it does make a lot of logical sense as far as from a historical standpoint. Ken Burns' version of the Vietnam War. I thought it was a pretty good documentary. I'm just about near the end, to whereas the war is in the early 1970s, so I know I'm near the end because I was in high school during the time. But what's interesting about it is the strategy and the behavior of the non-white people who are called Vietnamese. And it's awesome on their means to be determined to accomplish their goals. And it's something that all of us as non-white people can learn from. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, big victim in Alabama. Thank you for your patience, sir. Big victim, are you there, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. I'm here.
All right.
This big victim from God awful Alabama, I would like to first start off talk about AI. White people will use this to lie on black people. It's another tool to put in the arsenal to lie on black people. So black people be victims, beware. Gus, was that on the sunscreen? On the sunscreen, do you know if that was that a black person reporting on the sunscreen?
I will have to double check.
Well, black people, we don't need sunscreen. White people do. White people want to project their problems on the deficiencies on black people. We do not need sunscreens. We are sun people. As far as I pretty much agree with everything you said on Central Park 5, Gus. I think white people like to see black people in pain, and for some reason I believe it's white men making a lot of money off of this docuseries. Ava DuVernay, she's down at the bottom of the list of making money. And also, I've been engaged in a legal war with the state of Alabama for the interest part of my child support. Is there any victim out that's listening, that's on the phone, that can give me some information on trying to obtain an interest rebate on child support? Good to hear from firefighter. Hope to hear from Ivy. I've called in. I'm back on my counter-racist grind. And also, Gus, when will you be on the East Coast for the anniversary? When will that take place?
December 27, December 1st. I think those were our dates tentatively. December 27, to January 1, Florida. We'll have more details to come, all the dates, but or yeah, all the dates and everything. But that's what it should be, December 27, January 1.
That would give me time to get myself together so I can. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I don't see. I wanted to come to the first one, but I did. You know, you were serious about no meat eating, and I just felt, you know, well, you know, I just. And then you said it wouldn't be no standing, you know, standing around. You had to be active and doing yoga, you know, and all and everything. But I'm going to try to have myself together to do that. To come down to Florida. Thank you for letting me share.
Yes, sir, Big Victim. So the report that you asked about, Audie Cornish is the name of the reporter who is doing, who is conducting the interview. She is a black female. The person that she was speaking to, her name is Trisha Calvo. I am not sure. I will investigate to see if she is. Okay, looks like she'd probably be classified as white from the photographs that I'm looking at. I could be in error, but I feel pretty certain this doesn't look like there's too much ambiguity. With regards to, wow, I guess I'll address the yoga aspect first. We had a lot of folks in Virginia who it was their first time doing yoga, and you're not required to do every pose. Nothing is forced. You take your time. Like I said, we had a number of people. It was their first time doing yoga, and I don't remember hearing too many gripes. I think pretty much everybody was able to do the postures, and if you have a quality instructor at all, they should be able to make the postures accessible to everyone. Even when I had to do my prenatal training, I had to teach yoga to 88-year-olds. Regardless of what your situation is, they were talking about you on workplace racism and how you are about being efficient when you go in to speak to them, folks, your supervisors and what have you. Get in and get out. If you can do that, if you can move that briskly to make it a quick conversation with race soldiers, then you got to be in relatively better condition physically than an 88-year-old white woman. So you should be fine on the yoga front. Now, the eating, a lot of that is mental. And again, I think most of the folks who came to the retreat, they were not vegans. They didn't, you know, they weren't sitting around eating quinoa and crispy kale for the past 6 months. I think we had a lot of folks who were having red meat and chicken and all the rest of it. And they made it. The food tasted good. I don't remember anyone smuggling cheeseburgers in unless I missed it. Even though we did have some people who asked about that, but I don't remember no one griped about the food. No one complained about being hungry or being forced to eat carrots. We had carrot hot dogs, for goodness sake. Like, the food was the least of everyone's worries while we were there. I think the meat consumption is so much. It's not even just the meat consumption. Dr. Lathan, when she was on the program, I don't know if you heard her, but the second time when she was on, we talked about food additives and Cheetos and all of that. That's not even meat products. So much of the food products that we consume, meat and all, they have all those chemicals and such in them. That's why sometimes it can be hard to conceive of a world where you don't have Cheetos or Reese cups or hamburgers or cheese. It's because of the chemicals and how that stuff is addictive. That's exactly what she talked about on the program. It's not even that this food tastes that good. It's certainly not beneficial for your body. It's the chemical addiction that you have to all of the toxins and non-food things that they have put in the food. So that, I mean, hey, it's like a lot of drugs. There are withdrawal, symptoms, especially if you consume a lot of sugar and cheese and those type of things. Those are very addictive substances, caffeine and the like. So it can be a little bit difficult letting go of that. I think some people did suggest maybe trying to wean off of that in advance can be helpful, because it's just not healthy. The longer that you eat that stuff. It's not good for your body, and you'll feel so much better once you get off of that. So I will hush. Thank you so much. Hopefully we'll get to see you in Florida, December 27, January 1. Florida, that is the goal. More details to come. But even retreat or no, drinking more water, eating better, being more mindful about what we ate is super important. I think what did I eat today? Since I'm going to take all that time to talk all that nonsense, about an hour before we went on the program, I did about an hour, 15 minutes of yoga. And then I had steamed rice with kale, curry sauce, green onions, jalapenos, fresh garlic, ginger, tofu, and two spring rolls with kale and edamame. I used my air fryer. Was awesome, super delicious. I had water. I've had no non-water beverages today. I've only drank water, and like that's not even something to brag about. I think most non-white people on the planet drink water every day, mostly just because they couldn't afford to get all the cool Starbucks concoctions. Let's see, what else did I have? I had organic cornflakes with coconut almond milk, and that is all. Other folks, if you have commentary to share or want to share what you ate for the day, if you're trying to be mindful about what you put in your mouth, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks we have missed completely so far.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Doug. Good evening to all the callers. Interesting this week, I reached out to this firefighter. And I told him that, one day I sat down and turned on the television. I don't watch a lot of television, but said 25 greatest running backs. So, they was flashing Bo Jackson and people across the street. So I said, I'm going to watch this. So I sat down and I watched it. And they didn't show one clip of O.J. Simpson. Totally been written out of the history of the greatest running back. So I, reached out to the firefighter because I know he's a football coach. And I said, man, this guy was top five all time, and he's not even listed in the top 25, like he never existed. Man, I get exactly what you're saying. Those two things do not correlate as far as the case with Central Park Five and the R. Kelly trial, or the documentary. I think the correlation, however, that I make from the two is how after the fact, there's some type of, repercussions for something someone did after the fact. Now, of course, R. Kelly's repercussions is much, much, much worse than what Lederer and Epstein repercussions are, and look at their lives. However, it's just what I see is if this could happen, because think about it, R. Kelly's found not guilty. And if you could go back later and get them to put more charges, Bill Cosby. Coming back later, it's like you can't get away with crimes that you committed in the past anymore. It's like you could go back and be charged. I'm waiting for them to drop the statutes of limitations. I just think that's what I drew from this is these two white women were able to be affected for something they did. And by all accounts, they weren't punished for doing what they did by the people that were in the authority position to do it. And they could come back and be charged or be punished for that act. What does that mean for a black person? Mr. Jay-Z, so-called billionaire,
Most of his songs, he's selling crack. If he's gonna come, are they gonna come back and punish him for the music he made? You know, take his money away? I mean, I'm just thinking how that could work against us. Ron Artest was a victim, is a victim. He made good points. I think assault is assault. Ron Artest was provoked. He was assaulted first. He did what they would call stand his ground. A fan attacked him, and he was protecting himself. This guy assaulted someone who didn't assault him back, so that's assault. I would let a judge handle it, and the judge wants to give him community service, then fine. I want him to be charged with assault. And a felony charge, which I think that equate with Cal Lowry, just when he pushed a white man, I'm quite sure they would charge him with simple assault. A felony, you know, it'll be not a high felony, but something that would mess him up in the future. In the case of a white bitch billionaire CEO, I don't think that they can be CEO if they have a felony. Not CEO, it might be chairman. But in his case, he would have to delegate some of his power away, go through a whole lot of legal ramification expenses to be able to maintain his power on the back end. So it would really cost him a lot more than what it cost Ron Artest if Mr. Lowry was to go forward and charge this guy with, go to the police department and say he assaulted me and play the tape. The media is paying a lot of attention to the Dominican Republic. In this system, that is not a coincidence. I think they're just implanting in our brain the correlation between Dominican Republic and bad. We have all the white people and black people being found dead there, all of the people coming back sick, Big Poppy getting shot on TV, you know, not by coincidence. Usually when they start the media assassination of a country or the character assassination of the person, there's ramifications behind that. Venezuela, you could go down the list. YouTube, Gus, they decided that they were going to start punishing people for hate speech. And when I read the statement they put out, it not only includes hate groups, so-called hate groups, white racist groups who make racist comments, which I think under the free speech, they have the right to do that. They're going after people who are calling it a system of white supremacy as well. Anyone who is saying one group of people is superior to another group of people has the ability to be kicked out of the community now. And I thought that was very interesting. So if you're telling the truth, you can't be on there. Starting to turn into the black media. I had saw this article, I thought of you, Gus, a white yoga teacher holding class for white people to teach them about how white supremacy is in their body, mind, and heart. And this was in Seattle. This is why I thought of you. I said, man, I wonder if Gus knows this lady or has heard this story. I had a couple of articles here that to me, they showed reverse racism. I could get into those later. I know I'm narrowing down a minute. But California inmates can now possess marijuana in their prison cells with one catch. This came out on Fox, I believe. Either way, now they're allowing inmates in prison to be able to have possession of marijuana. However, the wardens are saying they're not going to let them smoke it. But, you know, I guess they could use it to do other things. I just thought that this was very interesting. And they went to court and everything to fight for this. Who's going to want to come home? I mean, this is terrible. I mean, especially if someone committed a crime against one of my family members and I'm just envisioning them up in prison, sitting in their cell smoking a joint. I mean, I don't see how this is productive to rehabilitating anyone. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, Gus.
Logic. How is this moving us towards rehabilitation? I am familiar with that report, the white yoga instructor in Seattle. That was on the front page of the Seattle Times this week, the Seattle paper. So I did see that. I cracked up laughing. I thought it might be someone that I knew at first. And then I checked and read it, and I did not know the white woman who's doing this. But she's doing the exact same thing, almost with the exact same title. Of what Anna Brown Griswold does. That's us. It's lots of these types of white women who go out and apparently can make a tidy sum talking to other whites and having exclusively white yoga audiences to talk about allegedly white supremacy. Yes, very aware. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, *61, if you have commentary to share, if we have missed you totally, proceed. Let's see. Thought there were a number. Oh, yeah. Quite a few hands, the folks that haven't spoken yet. Folks that we missed totally.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus and callers. I just wanted to give a follow-up, a report on the housing situation that I was going through. I'm being terrorized by one of my housemates. I had to get some, I had to basically take the situation to the owner because I had been being terrorized. It was last week and also yesterday, and it got into a point where this person was in my proximity and kept, being in my space and doing it intentionally where he was, every time I was in the kitchen, he would make sure he would be right there up under me after going through a situation with him being potentially violent with me. And it got into a point where we had some words. So what I did is I went, I discussed it with the owners, and he will be having to move in August. But that's a good thing, but I still suspect that there is some unjust networking. There is some texting whenever I'm in the kitchen. So this person is just popping up because when we were having this, little fallout, it was like, he was like right in my way. So where somebody is basically like kind of crowding you in and making you feel uncomfortable. And then basically he was trying to provoke an argument with me, provoking a situation. I had a talk with the owners, and he's supposed to be moving out, but yesterday he did the same thing. But what I did as a counter-racist move, instead of interacting with him, when he came in, he saw me in the kitchen, came right up close to me, and at this point, I don't want to be in any proximity with him because I do not feel safe. I told, the show that, how he cursed at me and basically was, pretty violent, in regards to his verbals. And, just listening to the show, I tend to take that stuff seriously now because of this show. So, I was proactive in that situation. And what I ended up doing yesterday to, as a counter-racist move, is I ended up calling the owner. I told him that this is, that he is still, you know, in my space. You know, like if you see somebody, you know, using a kitchen or whatever, you can just wait. If you see them, you know, using a kitchen, you don't have to be in there with me because, you know, given the situation that me and you have had problems before, I don't feel safe with you around me. So I called them and I let them know. They asked me what I wanted to do about the situation or what he should say. I said, we've already had this discussion. What do you suggest happen? So they said that, you know, he can at least let me know when he has to be in there. I said, or he can just wait until I leave out. So he did the same thing today while I was in the kitchen, but I just left out. It just seemed like he has this radar whenever I'm in there. It's like, you know, it's like it's intimidation tactics and, you know, the little methods that they use. And like I said, they have this whole unjust networking thing, where they text and they do, you know, little things to let you know, so they can harass, you know. And I'm just, I felt like it was somewhat like a win that he is moving, but, you know, I'm not enthusiastic about it. I don't, you know, because I still feel like there's still some racism being practiced in this whole scenario, given that I am the only black woman here, and I have to deal with being ganged up on with by these terrorists. So, like I said, I do still feel like I did accomplish something by using some counter racism. But you know, I did have to, you know, have some words with him, and I did record both situations when I had the meeting with the owners and with him. And that's what I wanted to report. And thank you for listening.
Much obliged. I'm sorry you had to experience that. I'm thankful to hear the words invoked safety. Anyone where they're being violent with you, and that's another one that I would include as well. And that's what I mean. These are not grievances. These are not complaints. This is a report of a potentially violent employee and a flagrantly unsafe work condition. That's the type of language that I would use in reporting this individual. And that is phenomenal when you have already articulated what's happening here. Unsafe work conditions, violent employee, profanity in the workplace, totally unacceptable. What do you think should be done about this, especially if you have the power to get this problem solved like in the next 5 minutes? Oh yeah, we've already reported. I've given you all the details. That's why they pay you the money, isn't it? Your salary is bigger than mine. What do you think should be done about this? In fact, does policy and procedure outline what should be done when there's a report of a violent employee and unsafe work conditions?
That's just a housing situation.
Oh, okay. I thought this were. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
But same difference.
That's right. That should be in the manual. That should be in the manual. What happens when you have a violent tenant who is threatening, you know, other tenants and making it unsafe? Would be the same thing and making it an unsafe situation. What's the protocol? Because I'm sure they got a manual on that. I'm sure they got a procedure. This is not the first time that they've had that sort of conflict in a housing arrangement. So I'm sorry that you've had to deal with that. I would make a police report with that as well. I don't know if we said that before. I said that for Kyle Lowry, the black male with the Toronto Raptors who was pushed by the white man at the finals, Mark Stevens, the co-owner. He should file a police report for assault, and you should too for any of that. That's the same advice I think we gave for the guy that was stalking, right? That was you too. The guy was coming up and just driving outside and stalking.
Yeah.
Those would be police reports.
And
as
I
well
think they have something to do with that, Gus. I do. I honestly think that all of this is all tied in. I honestly do.
it would not. So you already said there was some unjust networking. So it would just, how large is the unjust networking? That's all it would be. And that's why I would report all of this, because it might be connected. You don't know. If it's not, it would just mean that you've got two separate race soldiers. So either way, I would report that, especially if, you know, he's cursing at you and being violent. Like, oh, yeah, I would report that. That's totally unacceptable. I would, if you have other neighbors that are non-white that you have a good rapport with, I would let them know.
No, I don't.
Dang. Well, I would definitely try to let other people know that you who live at least close by, if you have other friends, family members, I would let them know what's happening just so that they can be aware, so that you can kind of contact them if that sort of thing happens again. I would definitely, even if it's not you calling the police per se, to have them come to your residence. It might be better if you go to them. And even some police, depending on where you are in some locales, you can do that online, file this sort of police report. But I would definitely do that. Yeah, and just have them, the property manager or whomever, get back in touch to you to what is the procedure for dealing with this and what should happen in the future, because he might come back or the stalk, who knows? What's the procedure for dealing with this in the future, anytime that he's here? And then what should be done if he returns? Those might be questions that I would ask.
Thank you.
Stay safe, system of racism, terrorism. Dr. Welsing and many others encourage the use of that term for a reason. This is terrorism. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, you have a hand up, proceed. Still see folks that are hanging out. I'll give out the number while folks, I guess, are getting their thoughts. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Do see folks that we've not heard from, but they are taking their time or maybe getting to a spot where they are able to speak. So while they are hanging out, the other folks, if you already shared, if you had an additional question, comment that you wanted to get in, feel free while we're waiting for the other folks.
I'll be heard.
Thomas in New York.
Yeah, played the clip one. Suntan lotion and UV rays, and ironically, there's a lot of information out there about a new technology that's called epidermal technology, or electronic epidermal censoring. They call it radio skin, dermal abyss, e-skin, electronic tattoos, digital tattoos. All of these things are created to be put on your body, and it will monitor, certain ones monitor blood flow. You'll be able to take your blood pressure, your temperature, and the display will just come out in the tattoo that's on your body. It's not a permanent tattoo. And then you have this one called dermal abyss that goes under your skin. And this one does a lot of things as well. One of them is it changes color when you get to certain UV rays. So when you're under UVA, it changes to, like, let's just say blue. It changes to green if you're in UVB. It changes to orange if you're in UVC. And it tells, pretty much gives you an indicator that your skin, even if you have suntan lotion over it, is telling you it might take longer to change the color, but when it changes color, you know that you're being exposed, so you need to put more on. Just one of the new tidbits that white supremacists have come out with. Reverse racism. I don't define reverse racism the way white people do. I call reverse racism when a victim of racism tries to say something racist happened to them and it goes wrong. They told white people reverse it on them. You go to say that Susan's a racist at work and starts crying and says she has a black husband and it all turns, all eyes are looking at you now, you know, she reversed the racist. I got a few. Oberlin College offered to pay $11 million to a local bakery after Flory Fine's college libeled its owners and interfered with its business relationships when some students accused them of mistreating black students. Two black students went into the store, were accused of stealing something from the store. The student body said that was racist and they refused to patronize the store. And those two students did plead guilty to stealing from the store. However, under the system, I mean, maybe the offer is good. So being that these two students were found guilty, the store sued the college for saying that the student body that didn't come to patronize the store cost them so much money. So the school had to pay them $11 million. Another story, 12 cops sued San Francisco, claiming they lost promotions due to bias against white men. 12 white male San Francisco cops who were passed over for promotions are still in the city for race and sexual discrimination led by a lieutenant whose similar case 16 years ago netted a $1.6 million settlement. The 13th precinct now retired says she was denied a promotion because she's a white lesbian. So these white men now are using this white lesbians follow, but that's not really the truth. See, there was a suit that was passed years ago, back in the 80s or the 70s, late 70s, in San Francisco, because the test that would give a police officer a promotion was racially biased. So in order for someone to be promoted, they took that test away to make it even. You get it now based off of your tenure and your service, not based off of this test that is racially biased. So these white men are really suing on the fact that they took away this test. They want this test back implemented so that way they can lean out people who can't pass it. But either way, what they're using in their suit against this whole thing is the test that these black officers who were passed over duly because they were black filed years ago. So either way, trying to use reverse racism, in my opinion, to get their way. The last thing I want to say is Alabama approved chemical castration for some sex offenders, I could imagine this would be a proportionate amount of black men and women who are probably chemically castrated for life. Don't have to cut it off, just shoot you with some stuff that makes it not work anymore and probably effeminize you. So I just thought all of that was extremely interesting based off of, you know, this was just 1 week in the news cycles.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. That is fascinating, the report about the new, medical technology or biotechnology. You get the temporary tattoo on your skin that gives you information about your heart rate and all that extraordinary. That they can do all of this in 2019, Bushwick Bill, dead at 52, prostate cancer. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943. pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. There are many, many suits where whites are suing for saying that they are victims of racism in a workplace context, that they didn't get a promotion or they were passed over, they didn't get a raise, or they only got, you know, black people in the higher positions and what have you. There are lots of suits of that nature. For a suit like that to come in the police department, like, wow, I would not be. In fact, I would be surprised if they did not win that suit in San Francisco. There are many. I think it, at least from my casual observation, whites tend to be substantially more successful in those suits than black people. I think I tend to see way more examples of white people who are winning, you know, sums of money for those suits saying that they are victims of racism than I do black people who are saying, oh, yeah, I was mistreated on the job and this happened, and they get some type of sum in a court. Are there other folks who dialed in that we folks who we've missed completely? Make sure you speak up before we get to the end of the broadcast. Do not wait until the last 5 minutes if you dialed in with a hand up and we've not heard from you at all. If there are other folks, I think Jay in St. Louis, some other folks said they had a additional comment or two they wanted to make sure they get in.
I'll wait.
Let's see.
You can go ahead, sir.
Let's see. Caller in Florida actually has not gone at all, so he should go first. I heard Big Victim. I think he got to share before. Jay in St. Louis got to share before. Those are at least three people I heard. Caller in Florida, if you want to go first.
Thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with the, it was two different terms. I think they were talking about Regions Bank. I know they use the term low income. The people that they were, I guess, charging on the interest rates, even if they paid off the loan, it sounded like that's what it was about. They were saying that it was dirty tactics. And I know that term definitely in the word God. And they also use the metaphor hand over fist. Like, I'm thinking the image of that is someone who wants to fight, I guess. Maybe somebody might agree or might not agree. Because, like, a hand over a fist, you know, definitely violence. And I'm wondering, I don't think that one is used that often. But that was one of the rare times I've heard that. And with the comparison of the Central Park Five and the R. Kelly case, it's reminded me of the black male epitomizing, especially with the Cuba Gooding Jr. I think it's reporting that he was arrested on something about sexual misconduct or sexual assault or something, and he was given a statement, I guess, with TMZ, about, you know, I didn't do any of these things. This is false. I have the evidence and the proof to show that I didn't do this. And so it seems like they're going on that pattern. But Stephen Collins and a plethora of other names of white males and white women, white men and white women participating in these same acts, and also to a greater degree, they're not focusing on them, of course. And my last point I wanted to make is there was a commercial, it's a local commercial that I saw, and it's about like local cars or whatever, like a car dealership. So it's this, they were having these three caricatures, and you know how people wear these mascot suits and they dress up in these costumes. So the three characters was a gorilla, right? And it was green, and he had on a gold chain with a dollar symbol, and it's white people in all of these costumes. So he's, I guess, he has like a whole bunch of money in his hand, and the slang Make It Rain, he was pushing out the dollar bills from his palm with his other hand, envision what I'm saying. And the second one was a genie, and he had on like dark navy blue paint on his skin. So definitely number two is the blackface thing that they're trying to portray on the genie. And the third one was a chicken, all right? Like a yellow chicken. And this was to market cars, I guess, the people who have low credit, quote unquote, and the exemplifying customers were white. I guess they didn't want to put black people in that situation in the commercial because I guess they thought it would look too obvious, but it's already overly obvious with those kinds of images. And that's a local commercial I wanted to share. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. Thank you for the commentary, caller in Florida. Be mindful. That would be another reason. Reading is more important than watching television because the white supremacy content is nonstop. Even the commercials are rife with that sort of white supremacy programming. Dr. Welsing talked about that all the time. And if you can be mindful in that sort of manner and be picking apart, you know, what you're seeing, and oh, look at that, they got the white people with the good credit and blah 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 and all the rest of it, great. But a lot of times people are not processing. We are not processing. We're just, you know, being entertained, and the white supremacy programming is having a big impact on our thoughts, speech, emotions, behavior. Let's see. I heard we have about 20 minutes. I heard at least two to three other people. Big Victim was one of them. Were you going to go? And then Jay in St. Louis will be next. Big Victim.
I'm just listening to this. Thank you.
For sure. Jay in St. Louis.
I just wanted to comment about Bushwickville and San Francisco really quickly. I'll start with Bushwickville first. I think it's very significant that he was young. And that you point that out, he was only 52. A lot of black men in my family have met the same fate as him. Before the age of 55, I know of only one in the last four generations who made it past 55. So this is a huge problem of early death from all causes, is what is reported in studies of public health that have been published, that all causes of cancer and just all causes of death in general, black men are among the first to die. And then secondly, with San Francisco, I think San Francisco is a great example and an unfortunate example of what can happen to black people and the social conditions we are subject to within America, especially economically. Things are not looking good. I don't know if that's a metaphor or not, but things are not good, and I don't see any evidence that they're going to be improving in that area unless we choose to do something about it in a timely manner. And that's all I'll say.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. Caller in Florida mentioned the financial report where they were talking about charging people interest at almost in a punitive manner if they had the audacity to pay off their loan early or to get it refinanced. We'll charge you some extra interest, and they use the word dirty in that report. Dirty is in the word guide. Avoid using these terms unless you are using them to apply to actual dirt as on the surface of the earth. Do not use expressions like dirty book or dirty look or dirty talk, etc. Do not say that someone gave you a dirty deal. Reason: the words dirt or dirty have been used by the white supremacist racists to often mean the same as dark and evil, dark and filthy, or dark and unworthy. White supremacists racists have often used the words dirt or dirty in such a manner as to associate dirt, dirty, dark, filth, and evil with black, brown, red, yellow, or any non-white people. Thus, according to many white supremacists, the words dirty, dark, and evil all mean the same, particularly when applied to non-white people. Notes: it is important to study the ways that people use the words dirt or dirty when someone uses terms like dirty words, dirty talk, etc. Ask him or her if he or she means incorrect words or incorrect talk. Ask him or her why he or she uses the words dirty in that manner. Dirt cheap is here as well. Other folks dialed in, if you have commentary to share. Last few moments in the broadcast, please do not straggle and wait till the last few minutes to speak.
Can I be heard again?
Yes, sir.
In South Florida, recently over the, well, it's been going on for a while, but recently they have been talking about deaths due to a, I don't even want to call it a medical procedure, but a procedure called Brazilian butt lift. How something that is associated with lifting your backside, associated with an area on the earth that contains a large level of non-white black people. I don't exactly know on why that distinction is attached to it. There have been females who have been dying in the process of this procedure in South Florida due to the functioning is to whereas the surgeon would take fat from parts of the body and place it in the buttocks area. Somehow, during the process of doing that procedure, I think fatty particles would get into the bloodstream, would cause some sort of negative effect, and the person would end up dying. There's been, as I mentioned before, there's been a recent amount of deaths due to something like this. And essentially, people are actually risking death or dying to get their backsides lifted. The only thing I do know that it is synonymous with the body shape of non-white black people, male and female, actually. But somehow people seem to be interested, even at the risk of their own lives, to achieve that look. I personally am not against plastic surgery 100% because it could be considered to be constructive with some particular instances with people who have, for whatever reason, an accident or some sort of problem that took place to where they were disfigured in some sort of way. So it can be useful to apply practice surgery, but somehow I don't think that this is the case with this particular procedure. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of like interesting. I've been noticing it over the past maybe 2 or 3 weeks down here in South Florida. Thank you.
Fascinating. Much obliged, retired firefighter. I did want to say the report about sunscreen. I have known some black people who did use sunscreen, especially when they were in areas closer to the equator. And I know when I was in Hawaii, that was one location. The sun I thought was quite a bit more intense than other places that I've been. I've been in Florida in the summertime. I've been in Texas and Louisiana, California in the summertime. I think Hawaii is closer to the equator than all of those places, and the intensity of the sun, I felt it. In fact, I think my, if I recall correctly, my shoulders did peel a little bit. I've never had that experience in my life from being out in the sun a lot in Hawaii, but I have known a few black people who did use sunscreen when they were in areas a little bit closer to the equator or spending a lot of time in the sun. We have other folks who had commentary to share. We have about a little less than 10 minutes. Don't wait till the last minutes if you have another thought, question, comment you wanted to make.
Congratulations being back home, Gus. I know you're glad to be back to your library.
Much obliged, much obliged. 17 months as a flood victim was... Wow. Yes, it's been an experience.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. This is Ken Steele, and I'm calling from Los Angeles. And I wanted to report that O.J. Simpson... is back on, or rather, O.J. Simpson is on social media. I guess this is in some sort of, it just happens to coincide with the 25-year anniversary of the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, which he was acquitted for. And I have to say that his Twitter presence is pretty entertaining. This is a clip from I think this was one of his first tweets.
Hey Twitter world, this is yours truly. Now coming soon to Twitter, you'll get to read all my thoughts and opinions on just about everything. Now there's a lot of fake OJ accounts out there, so this one. At the real OJ32 is the only official one. So it should be a lot of fun. I got a little getting even to do. So God bless. Take care.
God bless.
And, right? I'm sorry. My apologies. I'm sorry. So, OJ Simpson is on Twitter. And if you can imagine... it's just as entertaining as one would imagine. So, that's something that's been occupying a little bit of my time, just reading the replies, to some of his tweets. And I think he has a Father's Day tweet, that got some attention as well. And, he's just quite the character. And I think this matches up with descriptions of him prior to the murder that he's been blamed for in a number of different contexts throughout his life following that. And I think Ron Goldman's sister or mother or some female in his family is now going around, looking for attention, claiming that, OJ is the killer. And at this point, it just seems like a farce. But I think that the OJ Simpson trial and the all of the events preceding it and the re-incrimination of O.J. Simpson, I think it set a new set of rules for which the white community was going to deal with black suspects and black suspicion, especially celebrity suspects. I think this can be seen in situations like the Cosby trial, the Cosby trial and imprisonment, the R. Kelly documentary, and then most recently the situation with Cuba Gooding Jr., where the situation was caught on tape, and it doesn't even appear that he is guilty of what he's accused of. However, they are going through the whole rigmarole of having him do the perp walk with the handcuffs. He's hemmed up by two sheriff's deputies, and he is his mugshot has been broadcast all over the news in this very blatant overcharging of whatever occurred that you can see on tape that that didn't seem criminal at all. If you contrast this to the various criminals that are classified as white that have been accused of murder, you will not see them in handcuffs. You don't see any of these police officers that are accused of crimes. You don't see them being hauled off publicly. You don't see any of these celebrities that are accused of crimes. You don't see them being hauled off publicly. The celebrities that are involved in the so-called college cheating scandal, you don't even see their mugshots. So this is it just seems like standard operating procedure, but I think it's all related to that the feeling that white people had when they witnessed O.J. Simpson being rightfully acquitted of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson. And I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I was looking at report on Cuba Gooding Jr. Right now. They have the video posted as well. I think Dylan Roof was treated better than Cuba Gooding Jr. He got a stop for a meal and everything. We have maybe 2 minutes. Did somebody have a final comment they needed to get in before we conclude?
Very quickly, on the first casualty of the infamous cheating scandal, where white affluent students were taking scholarships from needy people and lying and cheating. A coach, he got a whole day in prison, charged to him, one day in prison. So I don't expect much to come out of it. And I'll mute myself. Rachel Gus.
Much obliged. I would not expect, if you can gun down a black person on video camera, unarmed black person on video camera, and, maybe you'll just get a good week on a GoFundMe page and have a few weeks of people saying bad things about you on TV, paid administrative leave, and that's that, buddy. Cheating scandal, my goodness, that's you don't even get community service for a cheating scandal. I mean, please. 30 seconds, anybody?
It was recently announced that all of the charges related to the Flint water crisis have been dropped. So how about that?
Chemical and biological warfare until proven otherwise. That was Dr. Welsing's conclusion. No surprise there either. We will call it a broadcast. We should be here Wednesday, Dr. Joy DeGruy. It's basically like we'll have two workplace racisms this week, because that is what Dr. DeGruy is coming here for. If you have questions, thoughts you would like to ask Dr. DeGruy, prepare. Should be normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Wednesday, June 19. With that, much obliged for all the folks who participated, listened in. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. I will say once again to all of the attempted fathers, continue your difficult effort. Being an attempted Black parent is extremely important. Share constructive material with your offspring. Share accurate information about racism, white supremacy with your offspring as often as possible. Folks that are going out participating in the so-called holiday tomorrow, again, try not to spend too many coins. Most of them tend to get back to racists anyway, so we don't want this to just be another excuse to finance race soldiers. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can go about the business of replacing white supremacy with justice immediately. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. This would also include not being on a cell phone when we're in the vehicle if you're driving. That is another easy excuse that they use to pull us over. Waste a whole lot of time. Not on the cell phone either. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.